This is the Who Wars Network. You have made the right choice.
Look out, this Rob and the team with the Who Wars podcast. The Alex and the Force, Blue Milk and Time Lords. It's the Who Wars podcast. It's the Who Wars podcast.
Hey there everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, episode number 33. This is a massive episode. At the time of producing some of these segments that have been sent in, I've already got a sense this show might go over 2 hours today, so Baz Hood, our faithful follower on Facebook, will be very happy. Hello Baz, if you're listening, I'm sure you are. And I think just in general, I think you'll all love to get in there and listen to the whole thing, or pick and mix, you know, the bits and pieces you want to listen to. That's the beauty of an audio fanzine like Who Wars. You can just go in and pick out the bits you want, like, oh, I think I'll listen to this interview today, and tomorrow I might listen to that feature. It's a little different to a discussion-based, panel-based podcast where you sort of have to listen in a linear fashion from start to finish to get the effect. Here, you can go all over the place. You can listen to one section, you can listen to it all, you can do whatever you like. So, I'm starting to ramble there. Let's keep moving on. What's been happening this week? Well, a few days back, I turned 40, which is quite a milestone in life. Let's not dwell on it, though. What else? I've been recently thinking about an appearance I made on television. This appearance was back in 1988 and was part of an afternoon program on the ABC here. The ABC is like the BBC in Britain. And the program's called The Afternoon Show, and they would play Doctor Who every day of the week. And for the 23rd of November 1988, they were debuting the brand new Remembrance of the Daleks episodes, fresh from the UK. And what they did on the afternoon show before they would play Doctor Who was have a little Doctor Who quiz. And I and several of my friends from the local Doctor Who group, some of the people from the Australian Doctor Who group who we sort of knew, but they were from another area, a whole bunch of us went in. Some of us were dressed up. This is in the days before we even knew the term cosplay. I was there as the fifth Doctor. My friend Harvey was there as the sixth Doctor. My friend Mark was there as the second Doctor, and so on. Kate Orman, who went on to write several of the Doctor Who New Adventure novels and some of the EDAs under BBC books, she was there. I think she dressed as her own Doctor. I think she called herself the eighth Doctor or ninth Doctor or something, because we didn't have an eighth and ninth Doctor at that time. Good memories. How did I get onto this? Oh yeah, I'm trying to find the footage. I would love to do a little segment on appearing on television back in 1988 for Doctor Who's, at the time, 25th anniversary. And like Patrick Troughton's episodes from the 60s, the ABC has actually junked most of its afternoon show archives. So I've been junked, like Patrick Troughton, and I am now on the hunt for people who might have recorded it, you know, to VHS for some reason, and have it. I have a few leads, and hopefully I can get something up, because I would love to do this little segment. It's something that's brewing at the back of my mind, and maybe it was because I was turning 40 this week that I started to think back to when I was younger and spunkier and, you know, all of that good stuff. So expect that in the near future. What else this week? Well, we have a new reviewer. We have Matt coming on board with Star Wars Book Reviews. You may already know Matt because he is on Twitter at SWCanonRebel. He's really into the new Star Wars canon stuff that's coming out. He's a fairly new convert to Star Wars. He'll talk to you more about that in his review later in the show. And I'll certainly watch his career with great interest, as a certain emperor might have once said. Oh, and while I'm talking about Matt, we do have another Star Wars book reviewer starting up soon as well. I'm not sure what episode that might be in, but she's very keen, and I really look forward to bringing her on. But we'll just leave it at that for now. Elsewhere in this episode, we have three interviews. And I know we're doing a lot of interviews of late. I think they're quite interesting. I think you out there like them as well, because we certainly get some good feedback on them. And because of this, I've started an interview page on the Who Wars website. If you go to whowars.net, you'll see a tab there for interviews. And what I'm doing is I'm listing everyone we interview in a meaningful way. There are some segments where we might have a line or two from people. That's not very meaningful. But where we've actually sat down and taken some time, had a few questions at least with someone, I'm listing them all there by their surname. You'll be able to go down and see the surnames and see what their job title is and so on, and see what episode they're in, and click straight through to the episode so you can always find interviews if you remember we did something and you want to re-listen to it, or point it out to a friend, or whatever the case might be. We now have an interview page on our website. Also, it would be remiss of me, I know this introduction is going on, I know I try and do quick ones, but it would be remiss of me not to mention that Alan, who does the Star Wars Rebels reviews with Jonathan here on the podcast when Star Wars Rebels is on the air, he has started his own Star Wars podcast. It's called Idiots Array. He does it with a couple of other chaps. They sit there in a sort of a discussion panel type format and talk away on topics. Their first episode is out now. Look up Idiots Array on iTunes. That would be my poison of choice, but you may have another option. Look it up, enjoy it. I think it's coming out under the umbrella of the Cantina Cast, if you know the Cantina Cast, and you should give it some support. Hey, it's Alan, it's one of our team members. Of course you should give him some support. Alrighty then, I think that's all I have to say, except for we may have another show going into the Who Wars feed in a similar way to how I mentioned Idiots Array sits under Cantina Cast. We may have another podcast coming to sit under the Who Wars umbrella. Who Wars may be becoming a Who Wars network of sorts. I haven't quite figured out the name yet, but stay tuned to our social media for that. It may start to come out in the off week to when we do episodes. So this Sunday we're putting out an episode. Next Sunday you may see something different in the slot, and then we'll be back the Sunday after, and so on and so forth. But we're just ironing out the details as I record this. I wish I could say more and put it into the podcast for posterity, but let that sit with us. We'll work it out, and you may have some more great content on the Who Wars feed. Okay, that really was a long intro for what I'm aiming for these days, so let's get on with it. Let's rip in. And I just want to say at the top of these features I've got is a very lovely piece I got sent from the Children of the Force podcast. Thank you to Al Nowotzki for sending this to me. He sits down with his kids and talks about, why do you like Star Wars? You might remember that question from a recent Who Wars episode. They were listening. They heard the question. They thought they'd write in with their interpretation of that. So that's what you'll hear coming up next. And then there's all sorts of good stuff in this episode. Oh my, I haven't even mentioned that we have an interview with Peter Harness in this interview. Peter Harness wrote Kill the Moon in Series 8 of Doctor Who. He's writing another episode in Series 9. Oh yeah, we have a Doctor Who writer on the show, and I'm not even mentioning it in the intro. That's how frazzled your mind gets when you turn 40, folks. That's how crazy things get. All right, I think I need to switch off this microphone, and let's just get on with the show.
Hello, Who Wars. I'm Al Nowotzki from Children of the Force, here with Anna and Liam. And we are here to answer your question, why do you love Star Wars? Anna, Liam, which one of you wants to go first?
Not me. I will. Because it has action.
Mm-hmm.
It has a lot of things put together, like romance, action.
Mm-hmm.
And I like it also because there's a lot of things that you feel sorry for. Like, when bad guys die, sometimes you feel sorry for them. It actually makes sure of that.
I'm exactly like Anna. That's what I was already thinking, and I just forgot that that was my thing. So
it has a lot of things put together.
It has a lot of things put together.
Which I like that. It's like, the action is tofu, and okay, the romance is peas,
mm-hmm,
and it's all put together in this big mashup ball.
Wow. All right, Star Wars.
And the niceness, well, they're like everything else is a different thingy, and they're all put together in one bowl.
Which one is Pepper?
The evilness!
So you're basically saying Star Wars is like scrambled tofu?
Yeah, basically.
Wow. I think you just struck on a new marketing strategy for Star Wars.
Marketing strategy?
Yeah, Star Wars. It's scrambled tofu.
Yes, Star Wars. Scrambled tofu.
Oh, mercy. So,
why do I
love Star Wars? I think so. Liam, your answer is Anna's answer. Oh, that's convenient. I like Star Wars because I love space and science stuff, fiction,
that's part of
and
it too.
Science fantasy,
yeah,
and,
that's part of it too.
And spaceships. And
I love fantasy.
My favorite thing when I was a kid to draw was just spaceships with lasers. And my brothers would always make fun of me because I'd always put as many lasers as I could on the spaceship.
Be, that's exactly what Liam does with his laser, with his Legos.
Yeah, here's a laser, and this one's a laser. I think, Liam, you probably call them blasters, but I called them lasers.
So what, sir?
And it just, I don't know. I love so much about it. You know what it is for me? It's so funny, Anna, that you said scrambled tofu, because it's, for me, it's comfort food. And that's...
Comfort food?
it's that thing you keep coming back to, that you know you love, and you're always going to love it, and it feels like home. It's just warm and cuddly, and it makes you feel so good. And every time I sit down and I see, you know, the words Star Wars or Clone Wars or Rebels, and that just that in that font, that Star Wars font, it's just, it, like I can go to the store and I look at a book rack and I can pick out the Star Wars books in like 2 seconds because all you have to do is look for that certain font, you know, and oh, there's the Star Wars books, I found them. It's so awesome, and it's part of the fabric of my life. And, you know, it hasn't always been as much as it is now that I have kids. You know, I was a Star Wars... Oh, thank you, Anna. That's so sweet. And this is getting really long, so let's call it good.
Yeah, let's.
Okay. Thanks, Who Wars, for asking the question.
Yeah, thanks, Who Wars!
May the Daleks be with you!
Yeah, Arthur C. Clarke.
That's fantastic.
That is in there, isn't it?
Absolutely, because I actually wrote a song about Arthur C. Clarke for another project many years ago, which means I can stick it in at the end of this as well, possibly now, but yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Arthur C. Clarke. Your world of strange powers made us scared of the dark. But your visions of the future made us look into the light, knowing that the world would be silver and bright. We fly around utopias in our rocket
cars. This week I'm excited to be talking to a man who has written words that on this very day are being spoken on a set in Wales for an episode of Doctor Who yet to be completed, let alone seen. I am really chuffed to introduce our guest, Peter Harness. Peter, hello and thank you for joining us.
Hello, you're very welcome. I hadn't thought about it like that, but it's, yes, I suppose that's true.
Well, I double-checked on one of these location guides today, so I know.
I wonder what they're shooting today. I can have a look just for my own amusement. Yes, it's lovely.
Well, last year you wrote the episode Kill the Moon.
Yes.
Now, what I would like to know, and what our listeners would probably like to know, is could you tell us, from a writer's point of view, the process of how a script happens, please?
Well, I mean, I've been a Doctor Who fan for as long as I can remember, and I'd been desperate to write for it. But I hadn't really wanted to kind of... I hadn't wanted to be too keen, you know. I left it until they actually asked me to go in and pitch them some ideas. I didn't want to be kind of bombarding them with stuff and feel weird and needy. So I went in and pitched a few ideas to them in, I think it was 2011, at the end of 2011. And I had lots of different ideas. And Kill the Moon, which I think just occurred to me as I was in the plane on the way over the night before. And I had a drink with, well, I had a drink with Mark Gatiss, actually, the night before. And I said, what do you think of this? I'm going to pitch this tomorrow. And he thought it was very good. And I thought it was probably the best one. So I kind of saved that until last. They'd all been kind of merrily nodding off to sleep. And then I pitched the idea that was Kill the Moon. And, you know, their ears pricked up a bit. So I think they asked me to go off and kind of, write a storyline for it, flesh it out a bit. And I did do that, and it went back and forth a couple of times like they tend to do. And then I had to go off really and do Jonathan Strange, which I was committed to doing. So it sat on the shelf for a while, and then when I'd finish on Jonathan Strange and Peter Capaldi was the Doctor, they got back in touch with me again. I kind of thought I thought the boat had sailed, but no, they got back in touch with me again. And that tends to be how scripts start, TV scripts. You know, you go in and you pitch some kind of idea, and you do a treatment, a kind of outline, although I try quite hard not to do them these days, and sometimes I get away with it, sometimes I don't, because I think all writers find it very boring to do outlines, because basically you're doing all of the work of actually sitting down and writing a script, and it's just like banging your head against a brick wall, really, trying to write an outline without doing any of the enjoyable stuff, like kind of writing dialogue and interesting scenes and things. So anyway, then if you're lucky, they'll let you proceed to do a script. And scripts usually go through 4 or 5 drafts at the moment. You know, you'll do a kind of big first draft where you get everything down on paper, and you get it into some kind of reasonable form, and then probably a kind of substantial reworking of it. And then if you're lucky, after that the changes get more and more minor as you go along. And I think probably you end up on any script that is broadcast or made, you probably end up getting to about 10 or 11 drafts maybe, but they're not really new drafts. They're just new versions of the script in which you've maybe kind of taken one character out or changed a couple of locations and things like that. So I suppose most scripts go through about 3 or 4 substantial drafts before they're ready to go.
You mentioned locations there, and one thing that I was interested in is, because you had an absolutely sensational location for your episode, the moon, well, Lanzarote, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yes. At what point does somebody read that script and think, well, hang on, we could go abroad and look at the moon, and how does that start affecting the direction of the script?
It will have been when the director came on board, well, when Paul Wilmshurst came on board, which, you know, would be about 8 weeks before. Maybe I don't know how long their pre-production period is. I can't remember, 6 or 8 weeks before they started shooting. And I don't know who came up with the idea of maybe doing it in Lanzarote. Often if you're really canny, these things can be a lot cheaper than you think, and they can really give it a lift. Up until pretty late on, it wasn't certain we were going to go to Lanzarote, because it wasn't certain we could afford it, I don't think. So there was always a kind of plan B, to do it in a quarry at night in Wales. But I think they went on a recce to Lanzarote, and they came back. They shot just a little bit of footage with Paul's phone or whatever, or iPad. And then they brought it back, and they treated it in the way that it eventually ended up looking on screen. They kind of put in a starry sky in the background and the earth. And I think that just looked so great. Everybody focused on how we could possibly manage that. If you go into Lanzarote, then they'll send you pictures of what the locations are, where they're thinking of filming, and what they'd like to get out of it, where they can get their kind of money's worth, basically. And so you start factoring that into the scripts as well. And probably, you know, I ended up reducing kind of the action sequences quite a lot, you know, because they had, I think they're only there for 2 or 3 days. So, you know, they just had a limited amount of stuff that they could get done. So it slimmed off a bit in terms of the kind of big set pieces. But I think what it added to it was pretty massive, really, because I think it looked tremendous.
Now, you mentioned about cutting down some action sequences there. One of the things that surprises me still every week when I watch Doctor Who is how each episode crams such a range of emotions inside an episode, yet still moves the story forward and fits a plot in and characters in. Is it hard work to address the balance of emotions as well as developing the plot?
It is quite hard work. It's quite a difficult show to write. You know, you do have to have some kind of emotional story and a decent characters, and it's got to be a bit scary, and there have got to be a few twists and turns and things like that. And it's a very hard balance to get right. And I'm sure plenty of people would say that I didn't get it right. So I probably, you know, I'm sure they'll say the same about the next one, because you can never get it right for everybody. But I mean, I was very pleased with the script for Kill the Moon. I was very glad I felt I'd written a kind of workable, decent Doctor Who story that that kind of managed to do all those things. But it is hard, and I don't really know how you end up doing it, really. I can't really kind of give you a kind of magical formula for it, because I think everybody who writes them writes in a different way anyway. I think maybe if you're thinking in terms of the kind of broader this sounds immensely poncy, but like philosophical structure of it, then it can be easier to peg characters and monsters even, and locations. It can be a bit easier to peg them into that. It's often weird kind of giving these kind of interviews about how you write or how you wrote a particular thing, because it often doesn't occur to you how you did it until later on. And often it takes somebody else to come up and explain it to you, and you think, well, yes, you might have a point there.
At the end of the episode, Clara and the Doctor watched the moon hatch from a beach. And when I watched it, I did like to imagine it was a beach somewhere on the east coast of Yorkshire.
Yeah.
The reason I think that is because I associate you with the film. From what I know, it's got inspirations in your hometown, which is at the seaside. And
yeah,
it's about 10 miles away from my hometown. And the film is Anybody There? Can you tell us a little bit about the film?
It's a story about a little boy whose parents run an old people's home in Yorkshire in the 80s. And it's about his kind of relationship with an old magician who comes to live in the old people's home, who's kind of equally depressed as the young boy. And they kind of go on a quest together to discover whether there's life after death. And they kind of sort each other out along the way.
You've talked about how you loved Doctor Who when you were younger, and how great it was to get to write that. The cast of Is Anybody There? Mm. For anybody who was growing up in the UK in the 20th century, is just amazing. It's this amazing popular culture cast. Michael Caine has some names that some people might recognise. Grouty from Porridge, and some people have no clue what I'm talking about. You've got Mavis.
Yeah, but he's Maester Aemon now from Game of Thrones.
Oh yes, he is. He's in Game of Thrones, yeah, isn't he? And Leslie Phillips was in there as well. It's like a UK popular culture version of those murals you get in some awful bars where they have those murals of Hollywood stars all together. But this was real. I mean, you know, did you have to pinch yourself when things like this are happening?
Yeah, you do, really. And I was very thrilled to have all of them. But a couple of them, I really did write the parts for them with them in mind. And it was lovely that they could do it. I mean, they were an incredible bunch of actors. You know, who you'd watched on telly when you were small. And it was amazing to kind of sit around with them, talking about all their kind of wonderful memories of doing stuff with very famous people now dead. And it was a tremendous privilege.
Is anybody there? Does it have a toe or a foot in reality?
Yeah, I think it does. It was always a story I wanted to write, really, because I grew up in an old people's home and in much the same place as the film is set. And I was also obsessed with life after death and ghosts and, you know, recording ghosts on tape and hanging around graveyards and things like that. And
watching
Arthur C. Clarke. You know, my one regret about that film is that I lent the kind of design team my copy of the Arthur C. Clarke's Will the Strange Powers book, which I got Christmas in 1984, and I never got it back. And that's a real, you know, that's a real arrow in my heart. Even after all these years, I lent them my ghost books, and I think they all disappeared off into some lockup somewhere. I adored Arthur C. Clarke. That rotating crystal skull.
Absolutely.
So I was very kind of I always wanted to write that story. That was a story about, you know, with aspects of my childhood, and it isn't my childhood, and the people there aren't really based on real people. Well, some of them are to an extent, but I mean, they're all fictionalized.
Yeah, it is really good. So that is something that people should definitely check out. We've mentioned Michael Caine, who does play a retired magician. I mean, did you have an interest in magic? Was there a retired magician?
There was an old bloke who was quite interested in magic. He wasn't a magician, but he had some magical kind of old magic tricks, which fascinated me. But he was going to be our first kind of resident in the old folks' home, actually. He died before we opened, and I remember being quite sad about that.
Now, here comes another slick segue.
Mm-hmm.
Talking of magicians, now you've already mentioned this earlier on. You've adapted Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell for the BBC.
Yes. Well, it's based on a book by Susanna Clarke, which tells the story of a version of England where magic once existed hundreds of years ago, but died out. And it's set at the beginning of the 19th century, during the Napoleonic Wars, and it's about how magic returns to England, and it's about the two magicians who bring it back, namely Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
We wish to know, why is there no more magic done in England?
I myself am quite a tolerable, practical magician.
Mr. Norrell!
I met a man under a hedge who told me I was a magician.
Buy these two spells from me, sir. They'll get you started.
I am Strange.
Indeed.
I hope with all my heart to live as your friend and assistant.
What do you mean by summoning me here?
What was the magic?
Can you tell me? I know why!
You have opened a door to hell and invited the devil into England!
Work to destroy him before he destroys us.
Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell on BBC One.
It's really like a big BBC period drama, which they always do very well, but with it's like a Jane Austen or Charles Dickens story, but with magic in it and special effects. And very, very good special effects, if I can boast a little bit.
Well, of course you can.
A kind of Hollywood scale special effects, but of course fewer of them. but they're very good. And Milk, who also do the effects for Doctor Who, have done a terrific job. When this comes out, everybody with any luck will be seeing it for themselves.
What's it like adapting the work of somebody else rather than creating your own project from scratch?
Well, it depends, actually, from book to book. Because I've done quite a few adaptations, and I had said to myself before I did Strange and Norrell that I was going to knock it off for a while and just concentrate on doing my own stuff. But I couldn't actually, in all, you know, seriousness, turn down the chance to do Jonathan Strange, because it's such a fantastic book, and it was such a challenge to make it into to a TV series, because I mean, it's often been called unfilmable, and I was very up for the challenge of doing it. So it does adapting things does vary from book to book, because different authors have different strengths and they have different ways of telling a story. I mean, usually what I do is I try and make watching a TV series, you know, something that kind of that will be familiar to people who've read the book. I want to make it the same kind of experience as reading the book, so you know, it has the same kind of feel and the same kind of like imaginative landscape of the book. But often often the same things don't happen. And if they do happen, they don't always happen in the same order or for the same reasons. You know, it may actually be kind of a very different story to the story in the book. But I think if I've done my job well, then people won't really notice that because it'll feel like the book. And it'll feel kind of like it does in your head when you're reading it, I hope. That's what I try to do. And really the kind of hardest thing that you find doing all adaptations is how to make it into a drama, really, because books aren't dramas. They're not staged or structured like TV is. You need to you need to see things on TV. You need to kind of fully imagine the whole world down to what people are wearing and what color the sky is and all of the little details, and you need to be able to get into characters' heads by looking at them, by looking at what they're doing. Whereas in a book, you've got full access to all of their thoughts, and you can spend a lot of time listening to their thoughts, which you can't do on TV. So that's quite a hard thing to get over, to kind of find ways of reflecting on screen what you can just be told in the book. It's making it dramatic. It's kind of giving the stories a proper dramatic structure, which works well as a piece of filmmaking, and finding ways to tell the story in pictures.
I think what I can actually do here is sneak off a little tangent. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about making something so it is a piece of drama that works on TV, one of the projects you were involved with was a biopic of Frankie Howard, who, for those who don't know, is a UK comedian in the 60s and 70s. And I do find it fascinating that you can take part of somebody's life and turn it into a drama, because how difficult is it to make something that's real into a drama?
Well, I mean, you've got to take a lot of liberties, really. And it is quite tough, because I think it's even tougher if you do something like telling someone's kind of life story from beginning to end. I think that's a very kind of tough thing to kind of make work as a drama. But what I did with Frankie Howard was I really just made it the story of his relationship with his his partner, who kind of masqueraded as his manager for most of their time together, his relationship with Dennis, who I met and interviewed over a few days, and so it's really based on his interviews and his memories of how they met and how their relationship kind of went on. And so it's quite a small story, really, and it's a little story about how you make sacrifices for somebody you love and how you kind of accommodate someone you love. And I think it's a rather sweet story, really. I think we handled it kind of well and sensitively, but I don't think it's something I'd do again, actually, because I feel a bit kind of antsy about telling somebody's life story and making those kind of judgments and compressing. You end up telling it not quite as it was, and I think maybe my view on it's changed since then, and I think that's probably not something I'd like to do in the future, because we didn't get any kind of complaints about ours, but I know the Hancock one did, and the Steptoe and stuff.
Steptoe, yeah. I mean, yes, yours did have a very different feel to it. And I think one of the dangers is that people watch these, but they watch them as documentaries.
Yeah.
And they don't understand that it's a piece of TV, a piece of entertainment. So, I think if you watch them in the right way, then that's fine.
Mm. But I don't think a lot of people do. I don't think audiences do, and kind of, I think for that reason, that's why I feel a bit uncomfortable about them nowadays, because you do just end up fictionalizing a little bit too much, I think. I don't know. Maybe I'll change my mind in future. I don't know. I'm still very fond of that. I'm still very fond of the Frankie Howard play.
It would be wrong of me as a Doctor Who fan not to scoot back to the intro and mention the fact that you have written a story which is currently being filmed for series 9.
Yeah.
In my head, this is what happened. you pop round to Stephen Moffat's to ask if he's playing out, and he said he couldn't because he's busy planning the new series of Doctor Who. Would you be interested? And he gets his toy box down, and he hands over to you the Zygons, UNIT, Kate Stewart, and fan favourite Osgood. Is that how it happened? How on earth did you get that amazing set of ingredients?
Well, maybe it did happen a little bit like that. He had I think he wanted to tell the particular story that we tell, and he had a kind of summary of it, and yes, and he asked whether I would be interested in doing it, and I said yes, please.
Is it more daunting having to write with those particular ingredients than if you were creating something from the ground upwards?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. I think it's pretty daunting anyway, writing Doctor Who, because it's really, from my own perspective, because I always want to do it well. I want it to be a good Doctor Who story. So I probably put an awful lot of pressure on myself, and so I don't think it was quite as high pressure as Kill the Moon, because I'd done it before, and also I was using characters who'd been there before, and I could kind of play with their histories a bit. And if I started thinking about kind of the weight of expectation that people must have seeing a Zygon story and seeing an Osgood story, then I would probably go crackers. So I've just tried not to think about it too much, and just get on and write something which is as exciting as possible.
Yes, and that's exactly what I've written down here. Exciting, isn't it?
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Yes, I hope so. It's really hard to kind of judge your own stuff, particularly as they're in the middle of making it. But the bits I've seen so far look very good, and I hope it'll, I hope people will like it.
I hope so too, yes. It'd be really exciting to see it.
Mm.
Now, I am contractually obliged by the podcast to ask the next question, and the question is, Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Doctor Who. Doctor Who, by a million miles. I'm sorry. I've never been a Star Wars fan.
Really?
Yeah, because do you know? I mean, I think probably it was because I love Doctor Who so much, and I was just watching Doctor Who at a time when everybody loved Star Wars. You could get loads of Star Wars toys, and everybody had those little Star Wars figures, and everybody wanted to play Star Wars, and nobody wanted to play Doctor Who, and you couldn't get any Doctor Who toys. So I always, I always felt quite proprietorial about Doctor Who, and I didn't want to like Star Wars because that felt like being unfaithful to Doctor Who.
Wow.
The same with Star Trek. So yeah, Doctor Who for me, by a long way, I'm afraid.
Oh no, there's no right or wrong answer to the question. It's always interesting to see what people say and what journey they go on with it. It's always really good of people to give up their time to come and talk to us. And so what I like to do is ask if you've got a good cause you'd like to promote and raise a bit of awareness for.
There's a charity called Arts Emergency in the UK, which has set itself up as a way of giving kids from less privileged backgrounds, from state schools, and kind of giving them kind of access to, well, to the idea that you can kind of that you can do something creative with your life, that you can kind of write or be a musician or a painter or a film director or something. And I think that there's an increasing kind of problem in the UK of getting kids from those kind of backgrounds into doing, more creative stuff, because it's all about the job market now. So I guess take a look at artsemergency.org.uk, I think it is.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I couldn't agree more. The arts always suffers, and you're right, it might not be the most important thing at the forefront of people's minds, but let's face it, everyone listening to this podcast loves comics, loves films, loves novels, loves Doctor Who, loves their telly, so it is quite important to us, and it's important that we keep it going.
Yes, it is. And as Churchill said, when they asked whether he would cut funding for the arts during the Second World War, he said, "No, of course not. Why on earth are we fighting this war otherwise?" And I think that's the way to think of it.
Wow, and I never thought I'd ever end an interview on a Churchill quote, but that sounds like a really good thing to do.
Yeah. Good.
Thank you very much for coming and talking to us. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell's in the UK this Sunday, and it's going to be on at 9 p.m. on BBC One.
That's right.
And it's also going to be on BBC America from the 13th of June.
Yes, which is a Saturday, I think.
It is.
I think it'll be on iTunes as well quite soon after the broadcast. So I heard a whisper about that today.
Brilliant.
Yes, so it'll be available. But don't torrent it.
Absolutely not. And, let's look forward to watching your episode of Doctor Who.
Yes, I look.
Later in the year.
Yes, and on winter.
Thanks very much for coming on.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
You and this other gentleman have been a great nuisance to the army. I have no need of a magician here.
What do they talk about that might harm you, Mr. Noll?
You have opened a door to hell and invited the devil into England!
And, come, I can make you king.
Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell on BBC One.
In the northeastern Sonoran Desert, south of the Grand Canyon, lies Arizona's state capital, Phoenix. With well over 4 million people, this is the state's largest city and one of the most populated cities in the USA.
Hey, Who Wars listeners. It's me, Kate, your rogue reporter. I'm coming to you this time from the Phoenix Comic Con. And I really enjoy the Phoenix Comic Con. I've been going for the last couple of years. This is probably like my fourth or fifth, I think. And, you know, it doesn't have the same magnitude, I guess, of like Star Wars Celebration, but it is a lot closer, about 5.5 hours closer, and it's my hometown, so I really enjoy this con. It's so fun to be able to interact with other fans. So today, Thursday, is day one. I started off my day with the first panel, The Dark Side of Doctor Who. That was a really well done panel, and I was kind of surprised. It was very full. It was probably like 90-95% capacity. And they did a top 10 list of the 10 most dark Doctor Who episodes. So that was really interesting. And it was a good mix of classic Who and new Who and lots of different Doctors in there. So that was really cool. Maybe in a future podcast, we'll have to go on that topic sometime, the darkest episodes. Could be pretty interesting. All right, so then after that panel, I headed over to my interview I had with author Chuck Wendig. So he's the author of the upcoming Star Wars novel, Aftermath, which takes place after Return of the Jedi and before The Force Awakens. And so, got to chat with him. He was really nice and cool. And be sure to listen to the next episode of Who Wars to hear my interview with him. After that, I went to the panel, Conspiracies, Star Wars Style. And so I actually just caught the end of that one, but there was some pretty good theories and different thoughts about things in the Star Wars universe. So unfortunately, that's about it for me today. I have prior arrangements this evening, but hey, there's still 3 more days left after this, and they are going to be jam-packed, let me tell you. So that's it for me this time. Allons-y, and may the Force be with you.
Welcome to the Valley of the Sun, where it is always warm and where the nature stands out from the landscape like a camel in a desert.
All right, people, Phoenix Comic Con day 2. I'm on the floor. This is my first time I've hit the floor. I just finished up with my interview with Paul Cornell, which went great. He is awesome. So again, be sure to listen next week for that interview. But yeah, so now I'm just kind of wandering the sales floor, trying to see if I can find anything interesting.
Learn all about your digestive system and more in the downtown Arizona Science Center.
All right, so the rest of Day 2 recap. So, I did a few more interviews for Who Wars with Brian Miller and Joe Caroni, which will be on the next episode of Who Wars. Then I got curious and I went up to the Heroes Hall. That's the area where all the, you know, it's got the Doctor Who and the Star Wars area, plus all of the actors where you can get autographs and all that kind of thing. So I saw Tom Kane sitting over there and I decided I'm just going for it. So I went up and I just asked him for an interview and he was so nice and awesome. And so I sat down by Tom Kane for about a half hour and was interviewing him. And, you know, of course, we were getting interrupted every once in a while by people wanting his autograph and that sort of thing. But, you know, I just waited it out. And, yeah, so be sure to listen in next time. Me and Tom did a Yoda off. I did my Yoda impression for him. So that was fun. What else did I do? I went to hear Jason Isaacs' panel, the Inquisitor himself. Didn't really talk too much Star Wars there, but man, if I could get an interview with him, that would be awesome. Maybe I'll still try for that. And then Tom Kane also had a panel that I went to. So, yeah, other than that, just a lot of wandering about and taking lots of pictures. So hopefully I can post some of those on the Who Wars blog. What else? Yeah, just having so much fun here. They kind of have changed things around this time with the layout and where things are located and that sort of thing, but it has definitely been for the better. There's been very little lines that you have to wait in, so that's awesome. And that's making people a lot happier than I've seen them in the past, so everyone is just in an awesome mood. Everyone is so excited to be here. And it is a definite different feeling than like Star Wars Celebration. That was just such an intense, crazy pandemonium for those 4 days. It's a lot more, like, laid back and kind of a nice vibe here in Phoenix. That's kind of the Phoenician vibe, though. We're pretty laid back here, so it's kind of awesome. All right, so I think that's pretty much it for my day two. Kind of ending it a little bit early, too. I'm not staying super late any of the days, which is probably good because I don't want to be too exhausted. All right. So I'll pick up where I left off tomorrow. All right, guys. Allons-y, and may the Force be with you.
A few blocks north, the Heard Museum of Native Cultures and Art is the place to see Navajo jewelry and ancient bowls and jars.
Okay, Phoenix Comic Con Day 3 update. I'm having a blast over here at Phoenix Comic Con. It's definitely been one of the best cons ever. And also, the city of Phoenix has been great, too. They've just been fully embracing the whole Comic-Con thing, you know, the hotels, restaurants. Even, like, there's Comic-Con-type pictures all over the streets and everything. It's just awesome. Way to go, Phoenix. So, what have I done today? I'm wearing my Afro costume, so I went to the Star Wars area, kind of hung out there, took some pics. I went to a Star Wars Rebel panel, which recapped Season 1, so that was interesting and informative. Then I went on to Chuck Wendig's Spotlight panel, so I already had interviewed him, but it was cool to hear him talk about different stories in his life and lots of fan questions, so that was really interesting. What else? Well, at 3 o'clock, I have a decision to make, Star Wars or Doctor Who. There's a panel about the Master and a panel about the Force, so I'm going to have to decide what I want to do about that. Then, Katie Sackhoff later tonight. I would, like, die if I was able to interview her. Maybe. We will see. You'll have to stay tuned for the next episode of Who Wars to see if I actually got the interview with Katie Sackhoff and any other people here at Phoenix Comic Con. Alright, I gotta run. Allons-y, and may the Force be with you.
Arizona is always basking in sunlight, and with its southwestern charm, rich Native American history, and deep appreciation of art and nature, Phoenix is an attractive oasis in the hot Sonoran Desert.
Bring brace yourselves, listeners, for a segment 7 years in the making. Right now, and for many episodes to come, Rob is watching the Clone Wars.
You know, folks, if you've listened to Who Wars over the past 30-something episodes, whatever it is, you will have heard me comment from time to time on the Clone Wars TV series. And invariably, you will have heard me say that I tuned out of it years ago, possibly just before it got very good, and as a result, I've spent years thinking the show was a bit underwhelming and a bit childish, while people whose opinions I greatly respect get around town saying how brilliant it all was. It's a bit confusing. As a consequence, I've been threatening to watch the series from start to finish for some time, and, based on a request by our team member Kate, to watch it in chronological order as well. A slightly different order to the transmission order, as some episodes did go back in time, whether you noticed that or not. Anyway, the plan was to start this in the Christmas holidays. When was that? 6 months ago? Yeah. But good things come to those who wait, and as of this episode, I am hoping to bring you a Clone Wars report every Who Wars until I've finished the whole series. This could be as little as covering one episode at a time. Other times I might have shotgunned through half a dozen episodes in the previous fortnight, and I'll talk about a lot of episodes at once. It will vary a lot depending on my real life circumstances. And, as I look at each episode, I've decided that, aside from commenting on the episodes in general, which everyone does in a review, I'm not doing anything new or groundbreaking there, I'm also going to specifically call out whether I thought the episode was too childish or not, given that was my main bugbear back in the day, and maybe was yours too. And what do I mean by childish? I think that's a really good thing to define right now because it can have negative connotations, whereas I'm not using the word negatively, to my mind, at all. You see, I simply mean elements that are there for the kids. Obviously, there's got to be a hook for the kids, as kids are a strong part of the Clone Wars audience. However, like Doctor Who, to bring Doctor Who into this, which also has children as part of its audience, I believe there are hugely varying degrees of what people interpret as being for the kids. I mean, you can watch something made for children, quotation marks, and wonder how it ever got past the censor. Such are its themes and imagery and the like. Episodes like that generally resonate really well with adults too. Then you can watch an episode of the same program the week after, and it's so light and fluffy and devoid of interest for anyone over a certain age, it's hard to believe they come from the same series. It feels like a different writer just failing to get past the basics of storytelling and just banging it out for the lowest common denominator, i.e. the kids. So anyway, that's the plan. I'm not seeking to watch the series with my mind already made up and just wanting to bag it from the start, nor am I going to try and see the good in every episode, no matter what, and try and appeal to those of you out there who still think Clone Wars is the greatest thing since sliced bread and are still appealing for its return. No, I'm going into each episode with simply an open mind, on a mission to see where Clone Wars sits with me as of 2015, and probably 2016 before I'm finished with it. So let's fire up Netflix and do this. Oh, and one last thing. There's no spoiler policy in effect here. The series is almost 7 years old at this point in time, and even the newest material is over a year old, so I'm assuming you've already seen it. Proceed at your own peril. Okay, the first episode in the Clone Wars chronological viewing comes from Season 2. And not even early in Season 2, but Episode 16. The episode is called Cat and Mouse. Do any of you remember that? It's the one where Anakin must deliver supplies to a planet called Christophsis, and Bail Organa's down on that planet, and the planet is under Separatist control. He encounters a Separatist commander called Admiral Trench, who's defending the planet, and he can't get through despite his best intentions to, you know, be a rebel and try all these different things. So Obi-Wan turns up with a rather phallic-looking stealth ship, which Anakin commandeers, and starts playing a game of sort of cloaking and decloaking with Trench until he manages to time his run against Trench's ship and Trench's missiles, which are also following him, to cause the missiles to hit Trench while his shields are down, having just fired his missiles and destroying Trench. That's the story in a nutshell. So, what did I think? The first thing I noticed about this episode with my fresh eyes for Clone Wars was that it felt very cinematic. The way the scenes were shot, the camera angles, just the whole look, it made it feel very big. It also felt very crisp. I think this might be because I'm getting used to the look of Star Wars Rebels now, which uses a fake film sort of grain to mirror the original trilogy of movies as much as it can. So that was quite interesting too. Story-wise, I've just gone through the story. It's quite straightforward. They try to get through a blockade. They can't. They try again with a different tactic and a different ship. And they can. And that's basically all there is to it. Character-wise, this is an Anakin piece. He shows all the hallmarks of being a reckless rebel without a clue who could be lured over to the dark side. Now, why no one around him cottons onto this and says, hey, steady on, sport, I have no idea. Maybe Obi-Wan's so used to Qui-Gon having been a bit of a rebel himself, and he never went crazy, that he's just used to it. Maybe that's part of it. And now for the big one, the childish factor. Happily, I'd say the episode is reasonably neutral on that count. Sure, the character of Trench is based on a spider and is clearly the most childish thing in the piece, something to make the Litleys think, oh, look, he's a spider, he is, oh, yuck. And he does this sort of Hannibal Lecter-like sound after each sentence, which is, you know, just a bit silly. But aside from Trench, the story of getting through the blockade and all of that is quite good. It's clever enough for adults to appreciate the tactic that Anakin uses, and it's that same tactic that will make, you know, the smarter child in the audience who wants to reach up and grasp concepts start to think about things like objects in motion and changing directions and how all this comes together. It's the kind of trick that Anakin pulls that I would have loved trying to understand as a child and probably recreating with my Lego or Star Wars action figures, you know, moving them around on the floor and having missiles chase them and so on. So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't lean into any dark territory or sort of adult themes or anything like that. But aside from Trench, who did distract me a bit into some eye-rolling and comments of, oh, is this necessary? I think it's just neutral. And that's fine with me. Overall, I'd say it's about a 7 out of 10 episode. It does the job, and it's nothing overly spectacular. The second episode in the Clone Wars chronological viewing comes from Season 1. And like the previous episode, it's actually Episode 16 of its season. The episode in question is called The Hidden Enemy. Is this one you might remember? This is the one where Anakin and Obi-Wan believe there's a traitor in the ranks while they're working with the Republic forces to liberate Christophsis. That's the planet we saw in the last episode. The Jedi suspect the Sith while Rex and Cody uncover information that points to a spy amongst the clones. The story then splits at that point into an epic sort of Obi-Wan and Anakin duel versus Asajj Ventress while Rex and Cody uncover the traitor, a clone who's known as Slick, who thinks the clones are the slaves of the Jedi. So, what did I think? The first thing I noticed, having just watched a Season 2 story, was this episode didn't look quite as sharp and cinematic. Maybe it was just an illusion, maybe it was my brain playing tricks on me, but I don't think so. I think they must have made some real leaps between seasons in terms of the look of the show. Not that you would have necessarily noticed this if you watched all of these in TV order, rather than the chronological order that I'm following. I also noticed this isn't quite a fit with Cat and Mouse because there's no sign of Bail Organa. They put him in the later episode, the episode which comes first chronologically, if that makes sense, but he's not in this one. So they do all that work to help him in the previous episode, but here he's nowhere to be seen or even mentioned, as far as I can recall. Our brains, I guess, can explain this away that Bail's just somewhere else doing something, or maybe he's even left the planet by now. Who knows? Anyway, we'll move on from that. Story-wise, I thought this was great. It feels a lot longer than its running time. There's just so much going on. Character-wise, it's a good insight into the clones and how through different experiences they do grow up as individuals with different thoughts and ideas, some of which can be very different to their brothers. Anakin and Obi-Wan squaring off against Ventress had some nice touches as well. Anakin rushing in to fight Ventress alone at one stage was just such an Anakin thing to do, for example. And then there's the childish factor. this story isn't childish at all. I was waiting for something to pop out and be quite silly. I was actually getting a bit nervous at times, thinking, oh no, don't spoil it. But instead, it's tight and tense all the way through. The cuts between the lightsaber duel and the clones hunting down one of their own are awesome. There's nothing here for an adult to roll their eyes at. Nothing. This is really good stuff. Something interesting I noted Slick was saying was that the clones were the slaves of the Jedi. This is one of the themes of the Karen Travis novels, such as Republic Commando Hard Contact and its sequels Republic Commando 000, Republic Commando True Colors, and Order 66, a Republic Commando novel, as well as Imperial Commando 501st. Have you read any of those? They're awesome. Ironically, it's one of the themes so-called Star Wars fans used to kick Karen from pillar to post about, yet I always found it a fascinating way of looking at the clone situation, and here it was, popping up in the second episode I watched. And you know, I hope the thought is seeded through more episodes, because whether you believe it or not that the clones are slaves of the Jedi, looking at situations from a certain point of view, no pun intended, is always a good thing to do. I could hardly believe the short-sightedness of fans who used to attack her over comments like that, you know, that the clones were in a sort of a slave army. These are fans who want to think the Jedi are all good all the time and could never do anything that could be misconstrued as morally questionable, and yet they can. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox about that, or you'll hear my entire hour-long defense of why Karen Travis was an awesome Star Wars author who I wish we still had today in the Star Wars family. Overall, I'd say this was a solid 8 out of 10 episode. Anyway, what did you think of these episodes? Can you even remember watching them? They were a long time ago if you watched them on their first run. Why not write in with your thoughts or record your thoughts as an MP3 and send it all to hello@whowars.net. I'll see you next episode with the next in the Who Wars chronology with, without looking it up, I think might be the feature-length movie that even had a small theatrical run. I'll see you then.
Hi, Who Wars.
Wait,
what's that?
It's a new voice.
Yeah, indeed. My name is Matt, and I've been kindly asked to review Lords of the Sith by Paul S. Kemp. But who am I? That's a good question. Well, I'm quite new to Star Wars fandom. I rewatched the films late last year as what you could class as an adult, and I loved them. Absolutely fell in love with them all over again. And after that, I watched The Clone Wars, I watched Rebels, Season 1, and I've read everything in the new canon, be it the four published by Dale Wright and even the kids' books. If you want to chat, find me on Twitter. I'm known as the Star Wars Canon Rebel, and I'll be more than happy to chat with you. But as I said, Rob has asked me to talk about Paul S. Kemp, and that's something I'd love to do. This book is all about one thing, and that one thing is power. Whether that be the power of destruction, the power of hope, power struggles, and even just pure physical power. Lords of the Sith is, in my opinion, the best book out of the new canon novels published by Del Rey. It is ran full of action and, best of all, some intriguing relationships and protagonists throughout the book. And these are going to be the basis of my review. But do take one thing into regard, a little warning as you were. The cover shows stormtroopers, AT-ATs, massive destruction. And you see a lot of massive destruction, don't get me wrong, but you don't see much of that other stuff like the ATs and the stormtroopers. We're always told not to judge a book by its cover, and you might want to do that in a literal sense with this. If you're looking for that, you won't find that. But you will find tons of blasters, star destroyers, lightsabers, and battles. Because the action sequences are insane. Darth Vader in the first chapter is just incredible. Paul Kemp recently tweeted about loving the term beast mode regarding Vader here. And if that's good enough for him, then that's good enough for me. He really is incredible. If you're going to read one chapter, and the first chapter is normally where you start, read this one, because it really is that cool. There are space battles, land battles, and even fights under the earth. So if you like action, then I think you'll enjoy this book. But thankfully, it's not all action and therefore no substance. Woven in amongst the cast of characters are some compelling relationships which add a lot of weight to the story. Being based before A New Hope, we know who is going to end the day on top. But Kemp kept my attention throughout the whole book, because of these fascinating pieces on the chessboard of Ryloth. The most enthralling story, and arguably the most important, is the simmering relationship between Vader and the Emperor. What I really enjoyed most about this book is the anguish that Vader goes through when following his master. You really get to see the man behind the black mask, and intriguingly, his thoughts are still here. He still has about his past. I've always seen Vader as an emotionless being. It's only changing when he finds out about Luke and the Empire Strikes Back and his redemption in Return of the Jedi. However, during this book and the comics that bear his name, we see reflections on his past. These include thoughts above his mother and heartbreakingly Ahsoka, who he even refers to as Snips. Is this a really early hint at his redemption in Return of the Jedi? Well, possibly. But this moment midway through the book shows Vader as a much more complex character than the cold-blooded killer we all know. But the whole other aspect of the relationship is the infamous Sith Rule of Two. Ultimately, the apprentice will normally kill his master, and Darth Sidious is fully aware of this, and even speaks openly about it a number of times. The fact he does this and talks about it with Vader shows a huge element of control and power over Vader. The stuff that we see so much of from episode 3 and onwards. We all know how this relationship ends, but Kent gives us an eye-opening insight into not only the early days of this fragmented partnership, but also the cunning of the Emperor. Now, the exploration of these two could be enough for some people, but Kent just keeps on giving. And so we move on to two other forms of power. Those who are agonisingly aware of it, and that's Cham of the Free Ryloth movement, and those who just want to run away from it, Moff Moors. Ultimately, one loses it all and the other has to accept the fact that power comes with responsibility and face up to their previous mistakes. I'll start with Cham. He was a really interesting character. We first meet arguing to himself that he is not a terrorist, but in his own words, a freedom fighter. And in my opinion, he is indeed the latter, and that is shown by his actions during the final arc. Cham has the weight of power and authority heavily across his shoulders. His life's work has come to this moment. The destruction of the Emperor, the destruction of Vader on his own planet, the freedom of his people. And all the actions and therefore the consequences are on him. Thankfully, he is mindful of this burden, but sadly that comes as a cost to his happiness. He gives up everything for those around him. We also see where Hera, his daughter, who gets a slight mention, gets her drive that we see in Rebels. But ultimately and sadly, we see the result of fighting for a cause continuously with your heart on your sleeve. That cause becoming bigger than yourself. Moff Moors, on the other hand, has done everything she can to run away from power and responsibility since the death of her wife. She is painfully aware that grief has led her to this, and she has made many mistakes in her leadership. A recognition of this at the end of the novel warms me to her immensely, and even though we don't find out what happens to her, I do hope she pulled through it as she changed immensely throughout the book and ended as someone with an element of control and dignity. It would be really interesting to see if she comes up again in canon and to see the change that has come in her. And there are many characters that I haven't even mentioned, and I'd implore you to explore them for yourselves, as I thoroughly enjoyed this book. The pursuit and use of power is behind many a good story, but Kemp delightfully shows us how people go about it very differently, and shows us that there are very few who can really control it and wield it. The Emperor is one such man, and as he says, strength is power, and power is the point.
Darth Vader comic issue 5 is very much a mid-season finale episode. It changes the direction of our expectations and raises new questions in the continuing story of Darth Vader's post-Battle of Yavin fall from grace. If you remember, last issue ended with Wookiee bounty hunter Black Chrysanthemum making good of his work for Lord Vader by delivering Dr. Silo 4 to him. Silo 4 is a mysterious new agent working very close to the Emperor. Too close for Vader's comfort. Vader leaves his psychotic and vindictive protocol droid 000 to find out what Dr. Silo is doing for the Emperor. We conclude with the death of Silo, but with vital information regarding his secret base and what we will find there. Vader's replacement. Issue 5 starts with a bold visual statement. The base of Silo 4 is a cybernetically enhanced space whale, a brave departure for Marvel and their take on the Star Wars universe by moving away from the saga's definitive architecture and technology and more into something a little more, well, Marvel-esque and reminiscent of their bold experimentation back in the days of Star Wars Weekly in the late 1970s. It's hard to describe this scene and what Vader and his mission companion Dr. Aphra are seeing, but I've said it before, and I'll say it again. This comic would make a great TV show.
To jinx anything, but I think we found the bad guy's base.
You are correct.
I was joking.
I am aware. Do not expect me to humor you.
Yeah, I know. But I have to say, it's impressive.
It is, if one is fond of abominations. Begin, Aphra.
Illegal boarding mission is go. Okay, ion charge pressure. 60 seconds until boarding. And Lord Vader, may the Force be with you. This is the greatest job of my life.
That was an ion charge status.
Circuits down, doors sealed, are cut off. Comes down to, currently at the main base.
Look! We've got an unauthorized docking!
Ready?
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 Sir, something's coming from the blast door! The bridge's under attack!
Droids, with me!
Roger, roger!
Open the door. You are not of the Force. Who are you? Who are you?
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange.
Vader and his droid army are confronted by two warriors, a male and a female. Muscular and athletic, they wield lightsabers. They fight more like the Jedis of the past with a martial arts style, rather than Vader's confident stance. A combination of Vader's confidence and confusion as to what these self-admitted non-Jedi, non-Sith warriors are, almost has cause to make him lose his concentration. But before too much damage is done, a voice commands the lightsaber-wielding pair to stop. We learn their names to be Aelin and Morty. The voice is Dr. Silo. How is he alive? Simple. This is not Dr. Silo 4. This is Dr. Silo 5. Silo is an advanced cyborg. The same data and info from one incarnation maps onto another identical body as a previous one is rendered dead. He calls it an immortal system. Vader had assumed Silo was creating an apprentice to replace him, as the Sith always had. One master, one apprentice. However, Silo sees that as old-fashioned, as does the Emperor. They both want progress to bring the universe under Palpatine's control. For this, more than one Sith apprentice is needed. We then get a whammy of fan-pleasing hits. Silo's experiments made up of cybernetically enhanced familiar aliens and droids from the Star Wars universe. A classic line revisited
and a guest appearance and a great one-liner from that unexpected source.
Your presence confirms my suspicions, Vader. Be grateful I did not program myself to be capable of holding an illogical grudge. You did nothing that I would not do.
I understood you were making apprentices here, but there is nothing of the Force of them. There is nothing about the Force, about anything here.
No, never apprentices, replacements. That is what this is about, Vader. What you don't understand and what the Emperor does. We have a chance to make something better. The universe is old. We are running out of time. I desire progress. The Force is obsolete. These are its successors.
This is blasphemous.
This has nothing to do with the Force, much like you, Lord Vader. I look at you more machine than man, and I see a bridge between the old world and mine. In many ways, these are your children.
Enough!
Vader! No! You will forgive Lord Vader.
My Emperor.
He is sensitive on the topic of children. I am here to prove that the Emperor only really needs an apprentice in a ceremonial role. Show me something worthy of my attention.
This issue does bring up some interesting considerations. Why is the Emperor so keen to turn his back on the Force to experiment with something new? Well, the clue is in what he calls himself, Emperor. Not Darth Sidious, or First Lord of the Sith. Emperor. He's much more interested in politics and the power it brings. He's nowhere near as devoted to the Force as other Jedi and Sith we've seen over the years. He used the dark side of the Force to manipulate a weak political system. Look how easily he exterminated Jedi. Perhaps at the same time he turned his back on the Force as a prime source of philosophy. Sylo's army of cyborgs with a never-ending life cycle is also a hark back to one of Palpatine's previous policies, the Grand Clone Army. He has an interest in this area of science and military rule. And talking of the immortal system, don't for one minute think Vader is safe because we know his future. What if, like Sylo, we have a whole set of Vaders? I'm just letting my imagination wander, of course. But that's what's great about this issue. It changes the game. From a simple story of Vader redeeming himself by Empire Strikes Back to a whole new set of possibilities.
Finally, there's a new 11th Doctor comic out, and the writer on this one is Rob Williams, the artist is Warren Pleece. I feel like I don't mention that enough, so I'm going to start doing that. Because they are amazing individuals with great comic abilities. Speaking of comics, I should probably say something about this one. Let me start off by saying it was very funny. It starts off with... You'll start laughing just a couple lines in, I think. They're driving a motorbike. They, meaning the Doctor and Jones, are driving a motorbike on the Berlin Wall. Something very dangerous. And not just because they're on top of a very thin wall, but because there are German soldiers shooting at them, both on the ground and in a helicopter. Oh, and also they drive into a vortex, which is also dangerous. Yeah, you would think it'd be very scary, but mostly it was just hilarious. You just gotta read it. To give you a taste, they'd have to make a decision of whether or not to drive into the vortex, and to make this decision, Jones uses these cards that he's got to help him make creative decisions in life. They'll sort of give you a prompt of to imagine yourself as someone or in a certain situation, and the one he uses in this particular situation involves an octogenarian named Marjorie, which I should probably research if David Bowie actually did this in real life. Interesting. Either way, it really is hilarious. He finally has his iconic red hair. Also in this issue, Jones, the David Bowie character, figures out his title for the Man Who Fell to Earth movie, which I finally saw. I've been meaning to see that movie for a very long time, but since the title comes to him in this comic, I figured it's finally time I saw it. Even though what he actually says is the man who fell to dinosaurs. Slightly different, but close enough for me. And mostly just wow. Wow is the big word that resonates in my mind right now. And probably will forever. And no, that is not a recommendation to see it. I cannot publicly recommend this movie. There are many inappropriate scenes. Honestly, though, I wouldn't be surprised if he had some of those creative channeling cards on him while creating that movie. I have to say, though, the experience was mightily enhanced just knowing that in the background of the film, just a little while ago, David Bowie had been traveling outer space with the Doctor. It made the movie so much better. Anyways, enough talking about that crazy inappropriate movie. Back to Doctor Who and the kooky, crazy stuff. So much creativity coming out of this issue. It was worth the month-long wait. There's some history we get to learn about in this issue. That crazy jump with the motorcycle through the vortex brings us to the Battle of Milvian Bridge. That Roman battle that Constantine wins. And it's nice because if you've been listening to Who Wars for a while, you know that a couple of us on this podcast would like to see more history in Doctor Who, and what do you know, this comic is bringing it to us. So yeah, we get to learn some history, Constantine converts to Christianity, and there's a surprise at the end that may or may not be part of history. I won't be giving that away because it's the hook at the end that you really should experience yourself, but I will say, it's a classic want-to-take-over-the-world type of alien creature that wants to assimilate all of you. Okay. Are we excited now? Yeah. Also, I guess I kind of missed out the important part that leads them to this battle of the Milvian Bridge. The Doctor, Alice, Jones, and Ark are all falling to Earth because they're chasing after a comet. Or rather, not a comet. You heard me correctly. I said, not a comet. That is the title given to this large object that is falling to Earth. Not a comet. And then we go to Roman times and we get that surprise I've already told you about, and that leads us into the next issue. I kept looking for Rory during this Roman history scene of the comic, but I couldn't find him, unfortunately. They should have added him in, though. If you're gonna have Roman times, you gotta have Rory. You know, they could have just snuck him in the corner somewhere, his little nestine version of himself. That would have been really, really nice. Oh well. Yeah, so I think that's basically it. It was a wonderful issue. One interesting thing happened, the fourth wall was broken. You know, that fourth wall where, like, a narrator or some character will be talking to the audience directly, or the readers in this case. So yeah, there's this part where there's this little tan box, and inside it's written, "Nota bene, the Doctor might be speaking some sort of ancient Gallifreyan here." But really what's happening is the Doctor is just speaking gibberish because his mouth is frozen. And it's so funny because this narrator, has actually no idea what's going on, or knows as much as we know what's going on, because we don't know at that point that the doctor's mouth is frozen and that he's speaking gibberish, not actual ancient Gallifreyan. It's just this completely misleading narration that goes on. Very amusing. At least I thought it was very amusing. I hope they do that again. So that concludes my review. Great stuff. Great issue. Go find it. Read it. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye, guys.
And what about cats as well? Do you actually have a cat in your life?
I do have a cat, yeah. He's called Rufus.
Rufus?
Mm-hmm.
Is he around now?
He's not, no. He's out at the minute.
I've got Astrid, and she's normally sat next to me when I record.
Oh, yeah?
You have to stop her from scratching or jingling, but I can just turn my head. She's sat on the fridge, so...
She's on the fridge.
Looking at birds out the window, so... she's not joining in tonight either, which is a shame since we've talked so much about cats. But Astrid, yeah, there, one for the Doctor Who fans, named after Kylie Minogue's character, sort of, more the fact that it was Elegant of Tardis, which I thought was clever as well. So, yeah, I don't normally ask questions about cats, but...
That's all right.
Possibly should be renamed this week, Pear Wars and Doctor Mew, which is a marvellous pun there. Over the past few weeks, we've had the pleasure of talking to a number of people who've contributed to Titan Comics' Doctor Who range, and we've spoken to writers, illustrators, cover artists, and now we add to that collection by speaking to a contributor whose name you will probably recognise, because when you finish the excitement of the comic and you think, surely that can't be it, you get to the end of the 10th Doctor comic and you find an amazing one-page comic strip by Rachel Smith. Rachel, good evening and welcome to Who Wars.
Hello.
If people do flick to the back of the Titan 10th Doctor comics, they will find a rather fun comic strip, which is called, Rachel?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, which is?
I was just listening to you. Oh, then. No, yeah. It's called A Rose by Any Other Name.
And it's an amazing little strip. What happens in it?
So yeah, I do the backup humour strips for the 10th Doctor series, and I kind of like his relationship with Rose, and when they kind of break up in a way, I found it quite heartbreaking. So I made some kind of breakup comics. So he goes through this sort of heartbreak, having had to leave her. And he does quite cliche things that you do when you're heartbroken. The first of which is he buys a cat. And so my comics are kind of about his adventures with his new cat's companion.
And it is a marvellous little comic strip.
Thank you.
If nothing else, a help guide to looking after a cat, because Rose, the cat, does scratch things in it and gets up to the kind of fickle, cynical mischief that cats get up to. But in the end always melts your heart, or in the Doctor's case, his heart. So.
Sure.
So what is the process of creating an episode of A Rose by Any Other Name?
Well, I've just been writing my 10th one today, actually. So I don't know, because it's a monthly thing. I usually start with kind of reminding myself about the Doctor and about that kind of series. So I knew kind of what I wanted the joke to be. So I suppose I try and get a Doctor Who reference in there and a sort of cat behaviour joke in there as well, and then a punchline at the end. So it's quite difficult with the page count restrictions, because I've only got the one page. So it usually ends up being these big, long 14-panel scripts. And then I thumbnail them, which means I draw the comic page very small and very roughly, and I send it to the editor. And he has always said yes, I think. I don't think he's ever had any problems with mine. A touch wood for this 10th one. And then, then I go to blue pencils and inks, and I scan the inks in, and I colour it on Photoshop at the end.
Wow. Well, I think one of the interesting things is that you've just gone through all of the things you do on that strip. When you actually look at the main strips in Titan, there seems to be a huge raft of credits, almost like a feature film.
Sure. I tend to work that way. I think as well, because it's a monthly comic, doing sort of 30 odd pages on your own every month would be a bit insane. You might go a bit bonkers, whereas I've just got one page a month, so it's a lot easier for me. So I think that's why they have a lot of people on board for the interiors.
You talked about how you try to get a Doctor Who reference in every story. One of the things I find interesting is that I've seen K-9 and a cat nun. I know from talking to other people that sometimes it's very hard to get the copyright for these things. So do you just go ahead and put these in and hope for the best?
Yeah, the only things I've been told I definitely can't put in the comic is the Daleks, because they're under a different copyright. I've not had any problems since then, but as I say, I do always check by sending my rough thumbnails, because it would be quite heartbreaking if I'd drawn a whole page and then had to change the characters. So yeah, I do check, but I've not had anything pulled out yet.
One of the things I found interesting and what I'd like to talk about in a moment or two is your other work.
Sure. Because
whenever I talk to anybody on the podcast, what I find is that when we talk about their other projects, you actually make a lot more links of how they came to be doing what they're doing in the Doctor Who world. Now, you have always self-published and have created your own graphic work, none of it Doctor Who.
No.
How did you come from being a self-published illustrator with this kind of work? How on earth did Titan find you?
Well, yeah, as you say, I self-published a couple of mini-comics a few years ago. I think my first one was 2012. And then through doing that, Great Beast, a kind of art collective, asked if I wanted to publish something through them. So I then did House Party, which was my first book. And I'd been doing conventions and comic shows and stuff. And it was at one of these, it was at the London Film and Comic Con, that the editor of the Doctor Who comic series came and asked me if I'd like to pitch for a job with them. So, yeah, I guess in a way I was in the right place at the right time, but in another way I'd been working hard and I'd got books out there and I'd been kind of touting my wares a little bit at these shows. So I'd been quite visible, I suppose. So obviously I said yes, I'd love to pitch for whatever it is. And then I emailed him when I got home and yeah, made a pitch for this backup strip. And they said yes, and the rest is history.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think one of the interesting things is you meet a lot of illustrators and young designers and artists who are busy there doing all their Doctor Who fan art, putting it up on the internet, which is brilliant, and it's beautiful artwork. And I say, oh, yeah, my aspiration is to draw Doctor Who comics and do this and do that with Doctor Who. And you think by focusing all of their attention on that one thing, they'll get that dream job. Where in actual fact, I think it's the other stuff that you can bring to a comic or you can bring to a publication that is key. And I think that is where you could definitely tell from your work how it led to becoming your strip in the 10th Doctor comic.
Sure. I mean, I think the idea of the humour strips is that it kind of offers someone else's kind of viewpoint to the Doctor Who universe. So, yeah, it wouldn't be the kind of work that would be in the main interiors. It would be kind of a fresh, new, humorous look at it. So I guess my work kind of fit the bill in that sense.
Although it does technically fit in a gap in the continuity, so that it does follow perfectly. So it could very well be canon.
Sure. Yeah.
Whereas the cat may appear in a future episode. Who knows?
Oh, I'd love that. I'd love that.
You've mentioned, excuse the rustling, but I've got your publications in the beautiful plastic bag that you sent to them, and I'm taking them out because I just want to talk about them.
Sure.
Because I spent a weekend reading them the other week, and I did read them in publication order, but I'm not going to talk about them in that order. I'm going to be quite random. But you've already mentioned House Party, so
yep.
I think it's right we mention House Party, which is your first full-length graphic novel.
That's correct.
Now, what's House Party all about?
It's about the kind of lost feeling that you have when you finish university and you have to go out into the real world. And it's about these three 20-somethings that all did kind of creative things at university, and they all did very well. And they're all now a little bit disappointed with the lives that they're faced with. Yes, yeah, so for example, one of the girls did fine art, and then she couldn't really get a job as an artist straight away, so she has to get a job in a coffee shop. And yeah, like, none of them are starving or anything, but they all expected a little bit more, so they decide to have a big house party to try and reclaim that feeling of lost youth, and it doesn't really go to plan.
One of the things I like in it is that they go and see a local band called the Helveticas. Aren't they?
The Helveticas, yeah.
Are they fictitious in this?
They are, yeah.
Okay, yes. So yeah. That's great fun. And then, so the reason I'm double checking if the Helveticas are real or not is because if we go back to your first publication, which is The Way We Write, and that's the central characters in that are a band.
Yeah, and they're a real band called Turning of Calla, who are, they're still going, they're going strong.
So the fun thing about this, though, is because even before you discover they're a real band, it's sort of got a feeling of the sort of Hanna-Barbera cartoons or the Saturday morning cartoons where you would have a group of characters that are one thing. So, like, you know, you have Gem and the Holograms are a band, or I don't actually know what the Scooby-Doo gang were. Just bumming around.
No, did they have those? I think they just...
I don't know, they just used to hang, didn't they? But they used to get into their adventures, didn't they? This is what happens in the Way We Write. The band go away and things happen. So again, I should let you continue because it's your story. And
The Way We Write, it's about a band who they want to write some new songs. So they decide to go on a writer's retreat to Whitby, but they end up staying in a haunted house with ghosts that want to steal their music.
There's a bit where the band are sat making up song titles, and they basically got this list of song titles.
It's almost like a cartoonist wrote these lyrics rather than an accomplished musician.
So the direction changes a bit with the next one, which is I Am Fire.
I Am Fire is about a teenage girl called Jenny, who is really bored during her work experience at like a haberdashery department, she's not very nice, and she's really mouthy and just wanting to coast through life. And then she meets a boy who's a pyromaniac, and he kind of shakes her life up a little bit and makes her question things that she's doing. There used to be a toy store called Domino's in Leicester, where I went to uni, and it had a haberdashery section, and it seemed to be run exclusively by sort of really moody teenage girls or really nice old women, and the dynamic of that just struck me as quite interesting. So I think that probably planted the seed in my head for that one.
Well, there are a couple of books in your collection that are sort of quite different, really. There's two. There's Ask Flimsy and Flimsy's Guide to Modern Living. I've never read a self-help book, but Flimsy's Guide to Modern Living is probably one of the best books full of advice that I have ever actually looked at. Who is Flimsy?
Flimsy is sort of like a cat version of me. She tries her best at life, and she tries to be good. She has a bit of a problem with wine. She likes the drink of wine. These are two books where she gives advice, and some of it's not very good advice, and some of it's really good advice. But it's all just very cute and silly.
It's cute and silly, but if you woke up feeling down in the dumps, so you'd had a bad day, if you picked up Flimsy's Guide to Modern Living, I guarantee it would make you smile and make you feel better about the world. Now, the other one, Ask Flimsy, is it came out of a slightly different project.
This has
definitely got one foot in reality, hasn't it?
Yeah, Ask Flimsy is a Tumblr, so askflimsy.tumblr.com or .co.uk, I can't remember. Which is a question and answer blog, so people ask questions and I draw Flimsy doing the answer, or kind of acting out the answer, I guess. I decided to do a book on like themed questions. So I asked people to ask her questions around the subject of love, and that book sort of collects my favourite 40, I think. I can't remember. Yeah, it's quite a few. So all the questions are asked by real people. A lot of people seem to think I just make up the questions, but I didn't, I promise.
Do you Are you naturally somebody who's good at giving advice? Or do you find it easier giving advice via flimsy?
I certainly try and support my friends and stuff, but yeah, flimsy's the only outlet I have for just giving random people advice on anything.
You have got some other projects coming out soon, haven't you?
I do. Yeah, I've got a new graphic novel coming out through Avery Hill Publishing called The Rabbit, and that will be available on the Avery Hill website from the 28th of August. So that's when it's launching. And yeah, I've been working on this one for about a year, or just over a year, actually. And it's about these two sisters, one who's 14 and one who's 9, who have run away from home, and they're like traveling through the countryside, and they find this rabbit that they decide to take with them on their journey, and the rabbit gets bigger and bigger and starts to learn how to talk, and it just gets really, really surreal and bizarre. It's the weirdest thing I've written so far.
And you have another project as well, don't you?
I
but
do.
This one's slightly different because this is...
Yeah, it's different because I've not written it. It's,
right.
It's called Blue Bottle Mystery, and it already exists as a children's novel by author Kathy Hoopman, and it's Jessica Kingsley Publishing has published that one, and they've asked me to be the artist on the graphic novel adaptation of it, and it's being adapted by Mike Medalia, who's also a comic creator you might have heard of. So yeah, and that's going to be out before Christmas. And yeah, this one's about this boy called Ben, who's 11. He's at school, and he and his friend Andy find a blue bottle in the school playground, and this kind of weird pink mist comes out of it and starts like following them around and helping them with stuff, and then they're not really sure what it is, and Ben gets diagnosed with Asperger's, so it's kind of about him dealing with that and about his friends learning how to communicate best with him and stuff. So yeah, it's really, really nice. It's a really beautiful story.
I'm just going to go down, we're not quite at the end yet, but I am just, while I've got it in front of me, just going to mention that all of these projects you could find out about at rachelsmith.org.
Mm-hmm.
I need to ask you the question that gives the podcast its name. Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Okay, I have been thinking about this. I'm going to go with Doctor Who just because I feel a bit closer to that kind of universe. And I came to Star Wars quite late because I was already in high school, so I didn't really grow up with it like a lot of people did. But I like both of them. But yeah, I'm going to go with Doctor Who.
We're always really, really pleased when people come and tell us about what they do and tell us about their projects. And it's really good of you to give up your time. So what we always like to do is ask if you've got a good cause you'd like to make us aware of, so people can maybe go and find out a little bit more.
Sure. Whenever I do any charity stuff, it's usually to raise money for the Alzheimer's Society, which my granddad suffered from a lot before he died a few years ago. So yeah, I've done a couple of parties where people have donated stuff, and my brothers have done like half marathons and stuff. So yeah, it's a really nice charity. But yeah, that would be what I'd choose.
Brilliant. That is fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're so welcome.
So, if you were paying attention to your social media feeds last weekend from Who Wars, or you subscribe to us through iTunes or a service like that, you would have noticed we popped out an episode in our off week, the Sunday where we wouldn't have normally put out an episode. And that episode comprised entirely of Lex and myself discussing our top 11th Doctor stories. It turned out to be quite a fun episode, and I've had a lot of good feedback on it, so we will be doing more in the future. Kate's already signed up to discuss the 10th Doctor with me. Andy wants to discuss the 4th Doctor, and John would love to discuss the 2nd Doctor, so you will hear more of those special type episodes in the future. But for now, in response to that, we did say at the end of the piece, you know, what did you think? Did you agree with us or not? And two of our team members have replied with MP3s. Kate and John have replied, and so we've got their responses lined up and ready to go. And let's start with Kate.
Hey Rob, hey Lex, I want to play the 11th Doctor game. Alright, so first of all, I have to say I agreed with most of your choices, especially you, Rob, and I'll get to that later, but yeah, all the episodes you guys talked about were, well, there's one that I didn't really care for. I don't know if I should go into that, but yeah, for the most part, very good episodes, and I enjoyed them. But it was interesting in March when I compiled my list of my top 10 New Who favorites. Of the four that Rob chose, three of mine line up with his. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And so for my top three favorites, I thought I would just read you what I had written on my top 10 list about why I liked the episodes. All right, first up, Vincent and the Doctor. Seeing one of my favorite artists portrayed on screen was enough to put this one on my top 10 list. But Tony Curran's astounding portrayal as Van Gogh was one of the most beautiful and heartbreaking things I've seen in my life. So yeah, I love Van Gogh. He's such an intriguing and compelling character from history. And it was so cool to see him on screen and to see him interact with the Doctor. Yeah, such an amazing episode. I love that one. Definitely one of my all-time favorite Doctor Who. All right, next up, The Girl Who Waited. Karen Gillan really outdid herself with this one. The scene with young and old Amy discussing their love for Rory is one of my favorite scenes in all of Doctor Who. And then third, Journey to the Center of the TARDIS. That's kind of an interesting choice, huh? Well, I really like this episode because we get to see so much of the TARDIS interior. You know, we don't really see that too often on Doctor Who. And so I think when I finally saw this episode, I thought it was so cool because you get to see so much of what the rest of the TARDIS looks like. I had been so curious about that. Alright, and then if you're curious, my fourth runner-up choice is also the Doctor's wife, just like you, Rob. Alright, so yeah, I thought this one had some fascinating insight into the relationship between the Doctor and the TARDIS, and it was just so cool to see the TARDIS personified. Yeah, just so cool. Costumes, the steampunk thingy going on. Really awesome episode. Alright, so great choices again, guys. And on my list, I also have four David Tennant episodes and then one of Eccleston and one of Capaldi. So if we end up playing the 10th Doctor game, I'll be really curious to see what episodes you guys all choose. All right, that's going to do it for me this time. Allons-y. Or I guess I'll make an exception just this once. Geronimo! And may the Force be with you.
All right, thank you, Kate. Moving on to John.
Hi, Rob and Lex. It's Jonathan. I just wanted to contribute my thoughts on the various episodes that you guys were talking about, and specifically the ones I think are, if not better, at least equivalent, possibly better, depending on your point of view. So I just don't disagree with most of the ones you selected. I have to say 11th Hour is the one I would probably have on my top three. I think it is a brilliant introduction to the Doctor, and I think Matt Smith does an amazing job taking something that no one had an aspect or understanding of what he was bringing to the table and just hitting it out of the park, to use a baseball terminology. The next one, I think, for me, if we were to go away from some of the ones you guys suggested, would be actually the Asylum of the Daleks. I loved that episode. I thought that was so great, and especially it brings in Jenna Coleman, which was even better. That was such a cool surprise for those of us that actually didn't know that was coming. And I thought that was just such an amazing episode all the way around that's one that I couldn't have done without. So that would have to be on my list. And I have to admit, the other one that I would probably consider amongst so many others, if I wasn't to include any different ones. So if I dropped 11th Hour, let's say I dropped that, I would have to include The Time of Angels, because I love that two-parter with the angels and Amy. And the other one I'd probably have to include would be a tough choice, but I would probably include The Name of the Doctor, because I loved that episode. I realize that's not an Amy episode, but to me that was a brilliant season ender leading into The Day of the Doctor, which is another one I would definitely consider if you wanted to consider that strictly as a 11th Doctor episode, which is absolutely 100% about as good as any of the other episodes of Doctor Who since New Who began. I really don't think there's a better one than Day of the Doctor. But if we take that out of the equation, then definitely The Name of the Doctor has got to be one of the big ones. It's just such a good episode and has such brilliant acting, and the way they use all the characters, especially the use of Melody Pond, shall I call her? River Song, I think, does a great job with that character and kind of finishing off that story arc with those two. And I think it's just such an amazing production. So it's probably one of my favorite episodes outside of The Day of the Doctor. And then honorable mention for me would be The Pandorica Opens, because I think that was a brilliant, especially the beginning part where he stands up on Stonehenge and basically calls out all the other aliens around and basically tells them all to go either come at him, or better yet, if they're smart, let somebody else try it first. And I think that was just brilliant. And the way that ended was so devastating for all the characters and left everything sort of hanging. So it works really well with Lex's choice going into that, which of course is the Big Bang. And I think those two episodes together are great, but I really like the first one even more than the conclusion. And another in a line of honorable mentions to me is got to be A Good Man Goes to War, because I think that was a very key and great episode. There's so many options. I could keep naming them off, but if we want to stick to just the three, I think 11th Hour, Name of the Doctor, and then Asylum of the Daleks would be the three I would use. Anyway, thanks a lot, guys, and see you later.
Thanks for that, John. Awesome responses from both yourself and Kate. I really appreciate you taking the time to make those MP3s. All right, that's all we really have to say. If you haven't heard Lex and I discussing the 11th Doctor episodes, do go back to our previous episode. It is a very, very fun discussion of some really, really top episodes of Doctor Who. All right, well, I suppose all that's left now is to close out perhaps with the man himself, Matt Smith. Upon leaving the role, here was his final comment.
I've loved it. I really have. And I'll miss it. But when you gotta go, you gotta go.
Okay, so I'm here with Jeff Victor. Welcome to Who Wars, Jeff.
How's it going?
It's going good. So I'm contractually obligated to ask you, Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Star Wars.
All right. Do you want to explain why?
Well, I've never seen Doctor Who, so I guess I can't really be a fan of it. I've heard it's great from everyone, but it's got so much mythology and so much back history. It's, you know, I kind of want to start at the beginning when I jump into any fandom. So
yeah,
it's like catching up in a soap opera. It's just very difficult. But Star Wars, on the other hand, I was born in 1977. I was a Star Wars so I was a Star Wars baby. And I remember, I was told I saw Empire in the theater. I don't remember it, but I do remember seeing Jedi in the theater. And it left a huge impression on me, to say the least. I collected all the toys when I was a kid. I watched the movie. It was the very first VHS my family got. We got a VCR and we got the Star Wars movies. I mean, it's just been a part of my life forever. I can't imagine, you know, I literally can't imagine life without Star Wars, or I don't remember life before Star Wars. So, it's kind of a huge passion of mine.
Awesome. I know when I was at Celebration and asking everybody why they love Star Wars, that was like a really common response. It's just part of us. It's for so many of us. Like, it's just ingrained in us, and it's part of our very being.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're an artist then.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us about some of your art and the projects that you've worked on?
Sure. I've been an artist my whole life, not always professionally, but I've always loved to draw, and I always loved drawing fan art. Some of my earliest drawings that my mom has still of me as like 3 or 4 years old drawing Superman and Star Wars. I'm not even kidding. I would love to share them with you. I don't know if you have a JPEG kind of, if you can show images on your podcast anywhere, but yeah, you got to see.
Yeah, we can put them on the blog on the whowars.net.
Oh, cool. All right.
Yeah, definitely.
But anyway, yeah, I've always done Star Wars fan art. And I don't know, I wouldn't say it's a living, because I mean, it's still just for fun. I mean, but I've had a job doing a lot of different things in the art world. I've been in animation. I've worked on things like at Warner Brothers, like Looney Tunes, and Powerpuff Girls and Scooby-Doo. And then I was working at Nickelodeon for about 7 years. Awesome. And now I work as a book illustrator doing children's books. So that's a lot of fun. And in the meantime, I go to different comic conventions and sell my work and do lots of fan art. And it's a blast.
So do you want to talk a little bit more about how you got started as an artist, like professionally?
Professionally? I mean, I went to school for art. I went to school for graphic design, actually. But I knew I wanted to be an artist. But to make my parents happy, I did some graphic design. Just because there was a little bit of doubt whether or not becoming an artist was a viable career move. But I always knew I wanted to draw, and I just kind of kept pursuing it. And I got turned down from, after college, I got turned down from everybody, of course. And, I just kind of found my way and got a couple of jobs here and there, and those led to bigger jobs. And, finally got some good gigs.
So, like, what advice would you give kids who are wanting to be in that field?
Give up. Just stop.
Yeah.
I don't need any more competition. No. I'm no, absolutely follow your dream. Follow your dream. I know it's such a cliche, but, I for a long time, I wasn't doing art. I was doing, because art doesn't pay the bills for, for a long time. I really have to get to a certain professional level to be able to make a living at it. But I was doing odd jobs. I mean, I was working as a janitor at one point, just whatever, whatever I could do. You have to have the passion to kind of continue, learn the skills. Yes. But also you have to kind of stick with it more than anyone else, cause there's a lot of people that can draw out there, and you have to kind of get your work seen by the right people. And, and actually, people, I'm speaking to the artists out there that are listening. I mean, you're in a really good position right now, because now you have an online platform that can reach the entire world. I mean, people, you could be drawing in the middle of nowhere and get hired by Disney if you're good. If you're on social media, if you're posting your work online, you can get noticed anywhere and get hired anywhere, which is kind of amazing. Learn the skills, have the passion, post your work. That's the best advice I can give you.
Awesome. That's good advice.
Oh, all right. You.
So let's talk a little bit about your artistic style. That's how I came across you when I saw that article on Geek Tyrant with your The Force Awakens.
Oh, really, sure.
Adorable. what is the medium you use for those generally?
I do all of my work digitally.
Okay.
I do paint traditionally once in a while, but digital is so fast. I mean, Force Unleashed pictures, I don't think I spent more than 2 hours on them.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And so it goes really fast.
So how has your artistic style evolved, would you say?
That's a tough question.
Cause like a lot of your work is like that, it's like that really cute, adorable.
Yeah. I've always had a kind of knack for drawing cute stuff. I used to work at Hallmark cards.
Cool.
So I always knew I liked drawing cute things. I've never been a very like angsty, gothy artist. I like drawing things that make people happy and make you know, make myself happy. So, yeah, I've always been kind of attracted to that type of thing.
Okay, so how do you think pop culture has influenced either your art or just the art world in general?
For a long time, I mean, fan art was almost kind of looked down on. You know, it was almost kind of like my friends used to say it was selling out if you did mm-hmm. fan art for a living, because it's like you're just, I don't know, copying other people's ideas and this and that. But honestly, I think it's a really good way, you know, to explore your fandom of things, and this latest explosion of, you know, kind of pop culture inspired art has just really gone mainstream. You know, 20 years ago, you weren't really seeing gallery shows devoted to pop culture. I mean, now I've got an art show coming up next week, which is here in LA, and it's Goonies. You know, they give the assignment to, you know, 100 artists, and each one comes up with their own interpretation of the Goonies. You know, there's shows like that almost every week here. You know, pop culture has become so collectible, and you see, you know, t-shirts with interesting interpretations of Star Wars characters, mm-hmm. or, you know, mashups with, you know, Doctor Who and Little Mermaid or whatever. You know, there's all these kind of things that people are really into.
This is a tangent, but
yeah,
speaking of Little Mermaid, on your website, uh-huh. You have all these like cute, adorable little paintings, and then you have that Little Mermaid one. What's the story with that?
Okay, yeah, well, you know, I do draw cute the animals and stuff all day long, and once in a while, if I'm in a bad mood, I will come home and, like, bust out some dark art.
Okay.
Yeah, just to kind of, yeah, I don't know, just once in a while, not all the time.
Yeah,
I want to do a whole series of that.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
Like alternate timelines for
Disney. Like the dark. Yeah, I was thinking my next one would be, you know, Gaston mounting the beast's head on his fireplace.
Nice. I love it. I can see that being a series like on BuzzFeed or something.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, well, let's hope so. I mean, that would be nice.
So you did those awesome The Force Awakens ones. Do you have any other The Force Awakens art planned?
Not at this time, but I am working on some in the same style. I'm working on some classic trilogy stuff.
Oh, nice.
And I should have that probably posted sometime next week.
Cool.
So stay tuned. I'm working on a very cute Luke and Yoda on Dagobah.
Aww.
So I hope you'll like that one.
Do you have any R2?
Yeah, he's in the background.
Okay.
But I haven't done a specific R2 piece, but you never know. I don't know. We'll see.
So have you done any other Star Wars art that you want to talk about?
Yeah. I mean, go through my website. I've got tons of Star Wars art.
Yeah.
But I did a cute little series called Bubbleheads a few years ago. That was all kind of like a little bit more graphic design Star Wars baby characters, but similar to the way I did these Force Unleashed ones, just more flat graphic.
That's cool.
You know, kind of Samurai Jack style.
Oh, okay, cool.
As opposed to like painted, you know.
Yeah. So you do like those, what do you call them? Like the evolution of the
characters? Evolution. That's kind of what I best.
You had like a Leia one, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
I forgot. What else?
I did a Luke one. I think that's the only Star Wars specific one. I'm probably going to do a Harrison Ford one with Han Solo coming up.
You should do a Darth Vader one.
I probably will do Darth Vader.
You can
eventually
start with Little Annie.
But I just don't really want to draw Hayden Christensen, so I've been putting it off.
I know, because you'd have to do, like, two of him.
Yeah.
You'd have to do, like, the teenager one and then the Revenge of the Sith ones.
That mullet rat tail thing he's got. I'd hate to draw that. But anyway.
That's true. So, yeah, it seems like you're not that big of a prequel fan.
Not at all, actually. I was there in line for days for episode one. I mean, I was so excited. I mean, much like everyone, mm-hmm. I dragged my girlfriend at the time to go see it. She wasn't keen on it, but she, you know, she was a good sport. And I got out of there and I was so confused, you know, because keep in mind, like, I had bought all the toys mm-hmm. and everything. I was so excited for this movie. Like, I'm sure I'm echoing a lot of people's sentiments about this, but I went home the next morning and just returned all the toys.
Aww.
And I saw the other ones kind of out of obligation, but I did not enjoy them, and I don't acknowledge.
Not even Revenge of the Sith?
No. Sorry. But yeah, I mean, there's some neat effects in them. I'm not going to lie and say they're completely worthless. They're not. There's some good stuff in them. No, it's just, I don't know. They don't have any magic for me. And I'm hoping that the new one, The Force Awakens, kind of brings it back. And so far from what I've seen, it looks absolutely magical. So,
yeah.
I mean, flash forward a year, I could be, completely bummed. I think that, honestly, like Lucasfilm, or not, no, I take it back, not Lucasfilm, Disney, sorry.
Yeah.
I think Disney has, learned from past mistakes.
Yeah.
I mean, they know what audiences want and don't want from a Star Wars movie. And I think they'll deliver, they'll probably, if anything, they'll probably be a lot more fan service than we're maybe used to, but which is also not a great thing either. I mean, you don't want constant, I got a bad feeling about this,
running
through it either. So, I mean, I'm sure they're going to do it, but, we'll see. I'm very optimistic. I was kind of hesitant until I saw the last trailer. Now I'm full bore excited. So, yeah.
So which room were you in at Star Wars Celebration for that first panel?
I wasn't there that day.
Oh,
I had to work and I was actually live streaming it. And with the rest of my office, we're all gathered around. I'm like, all right, you guys, shut up. Here comes the trailer. And we all gathered around and watched it. And I was just,
That was so awesome.
I was weeping adult tears. It was just unbelievable.
Did you see the Rogue One teaser?
Yeah, I saw that.
That was awesome.
I saw Battlefront, which was
cool. I'm not much of a gamer, so I didn't see that.
Oh, okay.
I did watch it, since then. That was actually pretty cool.
Yeah, it looks cool, but again, it's another one of these kind of game trailers where it's just like, wow, you guys made a pretty cinematic, and we'll see. But
well, there's always Disney Infinity, right?
There's always Disney. I haven't played that. I'm a little old for that, but I mean, I do like games. I mean, I'm playing a lot of games right now, but yeah, the Infinity. I'll probably collect the figures, but I'm not gonna get the game. Bunch of the little Infinity figurines, but they're cool.
The most recent game console I have is a Wii.
Oh, is that right? Oh,
yeah. Okay. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's all right. Do you collect anything Star Wars or?
I love I have a ton of R2-D2 stuff. I like to go to secondhand stores and stuff and just look for interesting stuff.
Sure. What's your favorite? I'm asking you questions.
I know. You turned the table, man.
I'm curious. What is the the weirdest, geekiest, kind of most unusual thing in your collection?
Man, that's a good one. Mm. Does it have to be Star Wars?
No, it could be anything.
Well, one of my prized possessions is my little R2, my voice-activated R2 that's
that?
Yeah, I got it at an estate sale for $5.
Oh, that's great.
And it works. I like to bring it to
those
cons.
Are expensive.
Yeah, it's $200.
Yeah.
So that's pretty awesome because it's voice activated and it actually moves around and stuff.
That's great.
So that's cool. Well, so at Star Wars Celebration, I was at the R2-D2 builders panel and they were giving away prizes. And I won one of those Gentle Giant action figures. So you, those giant ones, right? They're worth $80.
Yeah, wait, which one did you get?
The Luke and Bespin one?
Oh, Luke Bespin. Oh, well done.
Is that a good one?
Yeah. I mean, they're all good.
Oh, okay.
They're all cool.
I thought that was an extra rare one or something.
Oh, no.
But yeah, I just, I won that one. So, it was free. So that was pretty cool.
That's awesome. Yeah, well done.
How about you? What's your most prized Star Wars possession?
Okay, well, I have... This has to go a little blue here, but I've actually got the infamous C-3PO erect card.
Like the original Topps cards, you mean?
Yeah, it's that notorious.
Oh, I think I've heard of that. Card.
It's kind of legendary. You should Google
it.
You
have it?
I have. Okay, yeah. See, I've always thought it was, crazy, but they only made a few hundred, I guess. But apparently I found it also in an estate sale. And the guy was like a baseball card collector and all this stuff. And I was kind of going through looking for anything interesting. And I found the Star Wars card, and it was in a lucite container. It was in mint condition. And I asked the girl who's doing the sale, and she goes, I don't know, $10. I go, okay, I think it's worth like $300. So nice.
That's awesome.
But yeah, it's
were you trying to like keep your cool and be like,
oh yeah,
yeah,
oh
sure.
I was pretending like, I mean, she didn't know what she had, but they're very highly valuable to like weirdos like me. So I mean, there's literally nothing else like it in the Star Wars universe. Wow. I mean, it's just so bizarre.
Okay, so let's talk some more like just general Star Wars stuff. Who's your favorite Star Wars character?
Yoda.
Oh, nice.
Is there not Han Solo? Yeah. Okay, well, favorite character. Okay, well, I see it's hard because I have a lot of favorite characters, but I mean, if I had to pick one, the Empire Yoda is by far my favorite. Star Wars Han is my favorite, like A New Hope Han, mm-hmm. not Jedi Han, where he kind of becomes really kind of a jokester or whatever. And then in Jedi, my favorite character is the Royal Guards from the that protect the Emperor.
Oh,
just
wow.
From a visual standpoint, they're
gotcha.
Interesting looking.
Oh, so yeah. for the Force Awakens, like which yeah. ones caught your eye, like visually, like from an artist's perspective?
The first thing I noticed that I thought was really interesting was the way they are going back to Ralph McQuarrie's original designs.
Yeah.
I thought that's really cool.
Oh, kind of like with Rebels too. Have you been watching Star Wars?
Yeah,
Rebels?
Yeah, I have, and I think it's a little bit more blatant with that, but. Yeah. Yeah, I think going back to the well is very interesting, and I'm curious to see what they come up with, because there's nothing that I despise more, especially like in design-wise, than kind of over-designed outfits, like where, like in The Man of Steel, where Zod's wearing like 18 layers of this and that, and it's just like,
oh, don't
okay.
get me started about Man of Steel.
Ugh, yeah, well, don't get me started either, but
okay.
it's just so over-designed and overdone. Yeah. I mean, he's got like, even in Superman Returns, he had like little S's all over his costume.
Right.
It's like, just stop it, guys, whereas I feel like with this, they're going back to kind of like a retro simple design. Like Kylo Ren is the bad guy. I guess he's kind of more of like a kind of a monk, style thing, which I really like. I was not expecting that. I figured they'd do some kind of crazy cyborg Sith death monster, something with, digital arm, teen arms or something, but no, they're going back to something simple, which is great.
That's cool. Did you see the costume for Gwendolyn Christie's character?
Spoiler. Yeah, actually, I didn't know that was her. So,
did I just spoil it for you, or did you know?
No,
that?
Someone else spoiled it for me the other day, and I was like really trying hard not to know.
I
didn't know that.
Are you trying to be spoiler free?
Yeah, as much as I can.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at.
But, I saw the Vanity Fair pieces because everyone and their mom sent that to me.
I'm going to need to buy that.
Yeah, I'm trying not to know too much information, although people keep saying stuff to me, which is really annoying. Like, oh my God, can you believe that? Blah, blah. I'm like, shut up.
I know. I saw, like, on the Yahoo main page, there was this major spoiler, and I was so mad. I was like, what?
Yeah, I think I could have seen that too, and I clicked off as soon as I could, but.
But it wasn't even like it was the title of the article. Like,
yeah,
it's like what?
Yeah, but that's the thing with the internet too. It's like everyone thinks like, oh, I'm gonna get this information out there, but they don't. They're not considerate, and it's
Twitter can be really bad with that too.
And I unfortunately can't stay off social media for a year and a half, so right. I have to see this stuff.
I know.
It's annoying because I really want to just, freeze myself in carbonite and wake up when the movie opens. I almost don't even want to see a poster. I don't want to see another trailer. Like, I'm sold. Like, you got me. I'm going to go to the movie.
Right.
Like, I don't even want to know the story.
I know.
I'd actually be okay with not knowing that Harrison Ford was in the movie. Like, can you imagine just watching it for the first time in the theater on December, 18th? And seeing, Han Solo pop up for the first time, having not known that he was going to be in it.
That'd be cool.
You lose your mind.
I have a theory. You know how J.J. Abrams, like with Star Trek, he's like, oh, yeah, Benedict Cumberbatch. No, it's not Khan, blah, blah, blah. He kept saying, it's not Khan.
Yeah.
So I think there's going to be something really big with The Force Awakens. Like,
well, it's possible. Yeah, I mean, he's probably throwing out false leads, yeah, you know, which would make sense. I would too. So
I'm wondering if it's going to be Mara Jade to try, you know, like people were really upset about the expanded universe thing. I think that'd be cool.
I think it would be cool too, but there's no chance.
No, you don't think so?
They're not going to do it.
Way to crush my dreams.
Well, I mean, I don't know for sure. It's possible, but I don't think that they're going to do that yet. I think that if they do a Mara Jade, she's going to be in like one of these kind of outlier movies.
Oh.
But I don't see her being in this because there's going to be too much backstory with
her.
And, I don't know. I just feel like, because I mean, they said they're not going to do Thrawn, they're not going to do Mara Jade, so
yeah.
I mean, I take them at word. I would think that they're being honest, but who knows?
Yeah, I think they're just lying all the time. But yeah,
that's cool.
So do you have any other like crazy theories about what you think might happen in The Force Awakens?
No, I don't want to speculate. I'm trying not to think about it because all I did before Phantom Menace came out was like I would make up all these amazing stories about what I thought was going to happen. And what we got was like Darth Vader builds C-3PO. Oh, that's not what I thought was going to happen.
Yeah, it just leads to disappointment.
Yeah, so I just really don't want to even think about it. And the more I hear, the more annoyed I get about the movie. So,
gotcha. Okay, well, we'll change the subject.
No, it's fine. You're fine. I'm just saying, just in general. My friend thinks it's hilarious to spoil movies for me, so...
Yeah, I told him. I don't like spoilers.
If he ruins this one, I'm going to kill him. So,
okay. So, like, which movie is your favorite then so far?
Of the old classic trilogy?
Of any of them?
Of any of the Star Wars movies?
Yeah.
Well, Empire, obviously. I mean, come on. Do you have to ask?
Well, that's not everybody's. Mine's Return of the Jedi.
Well, Return of the Jedi is awesome, and it's like, but it, to me, it's like a, you know, an A movie, A plus or whatever. But Empire is just like an A plus plus.
Oh, gotcha.
It's just a little bit deeper. It's just a little bit better directed. It's more exciting. I don't know. There's something about it. It's just I've watched it. I don't know, 200 times, and I'll continue to watch it. So.
So yeah, I like Return of the Jedi because of Ewoks, but yeah. I just like, you know, that scene at the end where Luke's taking the mask off of Vader and his redemption. That scene just gets me every time. And
that's great. And then it's ruined by Hayden Christensen popping up at the end of the movie.
Yeah, I wonder if he'll have a cameo.
Thanks, George.
That's a topic for a whole nother conversation.
Oh, God, don't even get me started.
The special editions.
Yeah, but it's a good thing. I've got my, you know, I've got the original cuts, so I don't even watch those. I saw it once, and that was plenty.
I don't know if I've ever seen, like, the first time I saw Star Wars was the special editions when they were in the theater.
No kidding. Oh, wow. Wait, you hadn't seen them on video or anything growing up?
No. Well, it's weird, too, because I'm like the I'm the baby in the family. So like all my older brothers and sister, like they had seen it and they were all talking about it and like playing Star Wars and stuff. Mm. But like we never, I think we had a VHS, but we just never had the movies.
Oh, wow.
And so
I had never seen them in widescreen until then. But
oh, yeah, that was cool. Yeah. Yeah, so then, you know, I heard that they were coming out to be released and I was like, oh, cool. I can finally see these Star Wars movies. And then, like, my friend, her older sister, had the original movies, and she was watching them. And so, like, we went over there, and so my very first, like, scene that I saw was actually from Empire Strikes Back. It was the scene where Han is cutting open the Tauntaun.
Oh, God. You're like, and I'm out.
No, I was, like, intrigued. I was like, what? Oh, all right. So then I was like... So she's trying to, like, watch it, you know, so she could see the differences and stuff with the special editions.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, she's like, oh, well, we can start from the beginning. And I was like, no, I think I want to wait and just experience it for the first time on the big screen.
Oh, my God. So you've never seen the original theatrical cuts?
I don't think I have.
Oh, man. Wow. Okay.
I know, right?
Yeah. Oof. Yeah, that actually hurts a little bit. Yeah, I would suggest watching them because it's night and day. I mean, it's so much better. Oh my God. So you've never even heard the Yub Nub song. You've never seen the Max Rebo band when it wasn't like an awful CGI abomination.
By assimilation, you know, like I listened to enough like podcasts and stuff like that where I've heard that stuff.
Oh man. All right. Yeah. Get on that. Get on that right now. We're having a Star Wars party in a couple weeks. We're going to trilogy it up. So
sweet.
Classic trilogy only. No special editions allowed.
Or prequels.
Or prequels.
So how did you feel about the Clone Wars then, like the TV show?
It's okay. Yeah. I had some friends that worked on it, and you know, I thought the design of it was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't like the characters. I think that's the bottom line. I mean, but then again, you know, I love C-3PO and the Ewoks, and I hated the Ewoks and droids cartoons from the 80s, so I don't know. I mean, I think I'm just weird, you know, because like, do you remember in the 80s they did some Ewok TV movies? Did you ever see those?
No, I've heard of those. Never seen them.
Okay, well, if you like the Ewoks, you know,
Caravan of Courage or something, right?
Yeah, there's Caravan of Courage and then Battle for Endor.
Oh, okay.
And I was a little kid when I saw those, and even I thought that was a bunch of horse crap, you know? I was like, this is terrible.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, I don't know. I think there's something about kind of Star Wars for TV. I don't know. But I think Clone Wars is better than Rebels. Just my own. It's my own humble opinion. Yeah. I'm not Rebels that much.
You know, with Rebels, I started off like really excited about it. Then it like towards the middle of the season, I just was like not into it at all.
Yeah, and kind of clicked off for me too.
But then at the end with Ahsoka, like that was like awesome.
Oh well, yeah.
Spoilers. Oh, you've seen it, right? No, did I spoil it? Oops.
That's all right.
So you haven't seen all of that?
No,
it gets way better at the end. So.
Okay. All right, I'll finish up the season. I got
And then at Celebration, I got to see the season 2 premiere too, so that was pretty cool.
Oh, interesting. All right, all right.
So, spoiler alert, sorry.
Hey, you gotta be
You didn't
careful.
Hear that, though? That was like, I even had that one spoiled for me because I had been getting it on iTunes like the next day.
Oh no.
And I tried to like stay off, you know, like the night before, but like that one was like totally spoiled.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I'll check it out. It's not that bad. I mean, honestly, like I only get really annoyed when spoilers are for something that really makes a difference in my life where this is.
So there you go. Do you have any plans to start watching Doctor Who?
I may check it out.
Sweet.
I may. I'd say what's a good starting point, cuz I literally have no idea where to even begin. Do I start at every season or every doctor, or I don't know.
It's you could start with the, you know, like the first new episodes with Christopher Eccleston.
Okay.
He was the ninth doctor. He was only a doctor for one season, and there were some really good episodes that season.
Okay.
But like David Tennant, he's my favorite doctor. He starts with season 2. So I don't know, you might want to start with him. But I don't know if you would probably like Christopher Eccleston. You probably should start with that one.
Okay.
Because then you can kind of just start from the new ones, from the beginning. You get the story about Rose. But yeah, you got to make, if nothing else, watch the episode called The Empty Child and the Doctor Dances. It's a two-part one.
Oh, okay.
It takes place during World War II. It's like creepy, and it's like, it's awesome.
Okay.
Guess not. Have you ever heard like anybody say like, are you my mummy?
Nope.
Okay, that's from that.
Okay.
But yeah, so if nothing else, watch those two episodes, and then that'll probably make you want to watch like the rest.
Okay, fair enough. I've been trying to get into it. It's just, I don't know where to begin. It's like one
Netflix?
Of those things like, I do, yeah.
Because yeah, they're all on Netflix, I think.
Oh, really? Oh, that's
helpful. Well,
until helpful.
Like
okay.
the... Until the, like, they should be putting the last season on pretty soon, though.
Oh,
the new
all right.
He's the newest doctor, the older looking guy.
Yeah, yeah.
But have you ever heard of The Weeping Angels? That's another episode you might want to watch.
No, I honestly, like, you're going to ask me these things, but I have never heard of it.
You haven't even heard of it? I thought, like, no. You know, like, if you go to a con or something, you'll at least see, like, Doctor Who stuff.
No, sorry.
You just stay, like, in your own.
No, I... Yeah, you make it sound so terrible. I mean, there's a lot of things I don't follow. Like, if you were a big sports fan, I'd be lost, because I don't know anything about sports.
Yeah, so, I'm not.
I don't have a clue. People say, oh, you know the 1947 World Series or what? I don't know. Pick a date. No. I don't know.
Okay. Fair enough. So, yeah. Yeah, you should watch some episodes and then report back to Who Wars.
All right. Sounds good.
Awesome. All right. So, do you have any final thoughts on Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Star Wars is awesome, and I would love to give Doctor Who a chance. So, I'll check it out. And if your listeners would like to follow me, I'm on Jeff Victor Art on Instagram. And I have a blog, or I have a website, jeffvictor.com.
Okay, yeah. Cool.
So that's my plug.
All right, well, thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you. Had fun.
All right. L-O-N-Z, and may the Force be with you.
You too.
Well, here we are at the end of an epic 33rd Who Wars. You can probably hear the tiredness in my voice as I come to the end of this production run as well. My thanks to the team, as always, Andy, Kate, Lex, Jonathan, and our newest addition, Matt. By the way, as I said at the start of the show, he won't be the newest addition for very long, as we have someone else waiting in the wings to also talk about Star Wars fiction, and you might be hearing from her as early as episode 34. We'll have to see what happens. All right. I think that's all I needed to say. So, on to the editorial for this episode, or the back page, as we like to call it around these parts. Recently, there was an episode of Game of Thrones with a scene in it that shocked people. That's probably no surprise, as there's always an undercurrent of, you know, something going on that show, and it blows up about once or twice every season into indignant, "I'm never watching this show again" outrage from sections of its audience. But in observing people's reactions to that, essentially ignoring that they're watching an adult drama, not a children's show, where no one is guaranteed a happy ending, and just thinking about fandom in general, it dawned on me that there's an increasing sense of entitlement and ownership in fandom that I think is, well, unhealthy. And you know, there are so many examples of this, particularly in recent times, it's actually hard to know where to start. I mean, how about the video game Mass Effect? Now, there's something from left field you might not have expected me to mention. When its third and final game was released, well, final for the characters that are in it at least, the fandom for that game hated the ending. Even though there were multiple possibilities based on your choices in the game, no matter what they got, fans raged and wailed and basically made themselves look like absolute peanuts until the game company BioWare, in an unprecedented move as far as I'm aware, enhanced the ending again, hoping to maintain the fans' love. Now, I was repulsed by that. When an artist creates something, that is the creation. Full stop. End of paragraph. It's now a thing. It now exists in our world. Of course, you have the right to say that you hate it, or you would have done it differently. But you don't have the right to demand it be changed, and hey, if you can find a dozen buddies on social media to also tweet about it, feel that you've got a really solid case, and if you aren't listened to, it must be because the creators are really, really bad people who hate their fans. You see this all the time, don't you? I mean, it's shades of George Lucas and the Star Wars prequels, isn't it? It's everyone having a theory on how they would have done it differently. I'm no different. I, for example, would have maintained Darth Maul across all three films. But that's by the by. None of us have the right to change something that someone else has made just because we said so. I mean, who are we to say so? The right is always with the artist. When people make petitions asking that something is changed in someone else's artwork, I seriously wonder what planet they're from. Sticking with Star Wars, you look at the way people get territorial over characters like, say, Ahsoka in The Clone Wars, and now also in Rebels. They like that character very much, and any time someone even hints that there might be a final showdown with Vader, her former teacher, you know, Anakin Skywalker. Anytime they hint that could be on the cards, you see people snap, "No, you cannot kill Ahsoka!" Well, actually, yeah, the writers can. And not only can they do it, the death would be dramatic, it would add to Vader's tragedy that, you know, he killed his learner, he killed Snips. Oh, gosh. And it would move the whole Star Wars story along. It makes perfect sense on a creative storytelling level. Yet because these groups, particularly online groups, band together and think they have some sort of power, some sort of creative control, you know, or say in the matter, there'd be petitions, protests, the whole nine yards before you could say another word. But why? You know, why? Surely people who are into fandom so deep that they can name a dozen obscure behind-the-scenes people on any project they watch should be into the creative process enough to realise that, again, when an artist creates something, you have the right to say you hate it, or you would have done it differently, but you don't have the right to demand it to be changed or declare your way would have been the right way, whatever that's supposed to mean. And honestly, I think social media looms large behind a lot of this because it gives a certain kind of person the sense that they're actually close to the creatives on a series. When said creatives use social to ask, "What do you think?" they're doing it to generate buzz, they're doing it to make fans feel included. What they're not doing is doing it because they will implement the changes that some random and their friend on social demands. Now, I said at the top of this comment that this kind of attitude I see in fans is unhealthy, and it's because I think it's breeding an environment where creators are going to be increasingly faced with a choice in the future. To always give fan service and bring back popular characters and never kill anyone off and produce a kind of undramatic, two-dimensional, bland offering that anyone discerning is going to loathe, but which hundreds, thousands, hundreds of thousands of fans on social media are going to pat them on the back, thinking they're best buddies, you know, and they're somehow part of the creative process, and the show or movie will always conform to their wishes as if that's some sort of reality. But here's a hint, it's not. On the flip side, the creators can instead go with their artistic instincts, their desire to tell the stories they want, the freedom to kill off who they want, the capacity to make whoever they like the lead character, the ability to not give a damn what anyone else thinks, and uncompromisingly create the thing they always wanted to create. Knowing they're going to have protests and petitions and hate mail and people misinterpreting everything they've ever said, being painted as the worst person in the world, the subject of 10,000 memes, etc., etc., etc. All because they had the balls to go out there with an idea and do it their way, only to be criticised by people who have never created anything remotely resembling something talented. As you can probably guess, I am always 10,000% on the side of the artist, and it drives me crazy. You have no idea how crazy, although this editorial might be giving you a peek into it, that any time I see entitled, whiny, fan BS when something happens in a TV show or movie that doesn't suit them, I just blow up. I mean, suck it up, people. Deal with it. The fantasy worlds and beyond that we deal with and love to see in stories can be harsh places. Bad things can happen. The good guys don't always win. No one lives forever. And when someone gets bumped off, it's not always going to be the red shirt two rows back. It can be a major character if that is deemed to be part of the story. And sure, there can be moments of triumph and ecstasy as well. It's not all doom and gloom. But as they say, you can't appreciate moments like that. If everything is always hunky-dory and nothing bad ever happens, well, how do you know it's a moment of triumph and ecstasy if everything's always cool, you know? I am worried. I'm truly worried, actually, that as more fans make contact with creators, whether of games or comic books or TV or film or whatever, and they feel they have a say in the process, we might see more IPs going the fan service route. Some people will say that the Marvel superhero movies are so popular because they do include a lot of fan service, while on the flip side, the DC movies tackling challenging topics and showing a darker side to things they earn their share of negativity, yet on a purely objective storytelling basis, they're streets ahead of what Marvel does. And therein lies the problem. The great unwashed loves fan service because it makes them smile and they feel like they have a full belly. It's comfortable. It's like an old pair of slippers. They get cocooned in feeling good and they don't want to lose that feeling. So I get why people like that. But is it artistically right? Is it creating the best art? No and no, I think, are the answers to those two questions. But what about you? I'd be hypocritical to say all of this and think it was the only opinion worth having. Are you seeing more and more signs of fan entitlement out there? What do you think about it? Do you think fan service is okay? Why not write in to hello@whowars.net or record yourself as an MP3 file and we'll play it on the show. And on that note, I'll see you in a fortnight in episode 34.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars or if Facebook's more your thing at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.